Welcome to the virtual meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, San Francisco Bay Region. I am Jim McGrath, Chair of the San Francisco Bay Water Board. We will call the roll for the other board members in just 1 minute. But first, I want to note that sadly, today's board meeting will again be conducted in accordance with the COVID-19 emergency order to comply with public gathering limitations. As authorized by Government Code Section 11133, there is no physical meeting room. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. In addition, we are receiving public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you should already be in the Zoom meeting room. If you've not already received a link, you can visit our website and sign up. Our administrative person will please, at this point, share the website address. There we go. Leslie, thank you very much. And maybe you can put that in the chat room because it went by pretty quickly. And we want to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to comment if they're interested. For those in the meeting, in the Zoom meeting, you will be on mute and your camera turned off until it is your turn to speak. Our board clerk will then unmute you. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will again be placed on mute. For all speakers, we ask that you state your name when called upon. We appreciate your patience, understanding, and particularly your cooperation and kindness during this extraordinary time. We will now call the roll. I would like to recognize at this point Victor Alien, and I'm not even sure that I got that right. I have no phonic clues here. Hopefully I will be corrected. He's taken on our executive assistant duty until the position is filled. And I'll ask him to call the roll and tell us, Victor, how we should correctly pronounce your name. Victor.
Good morning. You said it pretty much the way I would said it. It's technically all Ailion, but I always say Alien.
Ailion. I will try my best.
No, you can stick with Alien. Okay. Board Member Young?
Here.
Board Member Gunther?
Here.
Board Member Hacker?
I'm here.
Board Member Kissinger?
He's here on phone, and I think there's some issues with that, but I'll vouch for him.
Sorry about that. I was muted.
Got it. Vice Chair Batty?
I am here.
Chair McGrath?
I'm also here.
Thank you.
Good morning, all. This brings us to the annual election of officers, chair and vice chair. We're not highly formal here. So the process is to make nominations, close, and then vote. Wait a minute. I had to roll this down to the right place. Tom Mumley, our interim executive officer, has informed me that we have new staff members to introduce. Tom, I guess you've got five members to introduce.
Yes.
On tenterhooks on the election.
Yes,
for a moment.
Thank you. I'm going to first call on John Wolfenden to introduce his new staff.
Hi, board members. My name is John Wolfenden. I'm a section leader in the Toxics Cleanup Division. And I'm very fortunate to be able to introduce two new staff. The first one I'll introduce is Catherine Ward. And Catherine, if you haven't already, turn on your camera and audio. Catherine joins us as an engineering geologist. She has a bachelor's degree in geology from the University of Iowa and a master's in geology from UC Santa Barbara. And Catherine has 11 years of experience as an environmental consultant, and she recently obtained her professional geologist license. Catherine, could you say hello and elaborate briefly on your experience and personal interests?
Yes. Hello, board. My name is Catherine Ward. I am a geologist. As John mentioned, I have a little over 10 years experience in environmental consulting. I've worked primarily on leaking underground storage tank cases all across California. And I've also worked on other unique projects like a former crude oil pipeline project in the Central Valley, where the land was undergoing various stages of redevelopment. So I'm really excited to apply my experience and knowledge for this role. Personally, I live in the East Bay and with my family, and we have a six-year-old little girl named Emily and a 1.5-year-old golden retriever, mutt, terrier, puppy, and they both keep us very busy in our spare time. So thank you, and I'm really excited to be here.
Okay, thanks, Catherine. Min, can you turn on your camera and your audio? So the next person I'm going to introduce, Min Ngo, is another new engineering geologist in the Toxics Cleanup Division. Min has a double major from USC in Earth Sciences and Environmental Studies and 5 years of experience in the environmental field. And he also recently obtained his professional geologist license. Min, could you say hello and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hello, everyone. So I worked for about 5 years as an environmental consultant, where I was sent to do a lot of field work as a staff geologist. So in addition to the UST cleanups and dry cleaner sites that I worked on, I also was sent to work in environmental health and safety, some landfill work, drilling and sampling, and some stormwater sampling at mine sites. In Southern California, I was sent down there to do construction oversight, methane gas sampling, and oil well abandonments. So I have experience in a lot of different fields, and I wore just a lot of hats as a staff geologist. Personally, outside of work, I'm interested in playing volleyball, hiking, traveling to national parks, and road biking in my local neighborhood, which is Union City, Fremont, Newark area. And yeah, thanks for having me, and I look forward to a long, rewarding career at the Water Board.
Yeah. Thank you both, Catherine and Min, and we're very fortunate to have you.
Welcome. Okay.
Yeah. So now Ron Gullibo, another one of our seniors, has some staff to introduce.
Thanks, Tom. Sure. I'll start with Katie. Katie Kula, turn your light up or your camera on, please. So hello, board members. My name's Ron Gullibo. I'm the supervisor in the news section. We're calling it section 4 for lack of creativity, but we were fortunate enough to hire Katie Kula. She is a professional engineer, registered, and she has an education, bachelor's degree in civil engineering from Clemson University in South Carolina. And then she has her master's degree from the University of Colorado in Boulder. I think I mentioned she is a professional licensed engineer. Katie has worked over the past 13 years in the environmental field, a combination of private consulting and as a regulator in the state of Washington. One of the projects she worked on that kind of caught our eye was this Duwamish River cleanup in Seattle, which had combined PCB contamination in sediment and in the upland area. So kind of parallel to what we're trying to pull together here. So more recently, she's been in private environmental consulting in the Bay Area, and she's worked on some mine and fire cleanups for various agencies. So that's her, you know, blurb on the professional side, and I'll turn it over to Katie to tell us what she likes to do for her fun and where she lives and that information.
Thanks, Ron, and thanks, everyone. Happy to be here back in the regulatory world. I have been in the Bay Area for about 3.5 years now. I live in Oakland. I just recently got a puppy, so that is keeping me very busy. but I also really like to, I've gotten into stand-up paddleboarding. It's kind of neat to see some of these waterways that we're going to be working on keeping clean or cleaning up. And I'm also really like to garden in my backyard. I'm one of those COVID gardeners. Happy to be here, like I said. Nice to meet you all.
Well, Katie, my family's from Seattle.
And, oh, yeah.
So I'm really pleased that your efforts up there on the Duwamish. We don't restrict our values in protecting and wishing for quality waters just to the state of California. So thank you for that.
Yeah, no problem. It's a big project. It was great to be involved even for a little while.
All right.
Then that brings us to Jeff Melby. Go ahead and turn your camera on as well, Jeff. And so I should also mention that both these people had started working here in January. So they've been on the job for a little over a month or coming up on a month. And so we missed the introduction to the last board meeting. But regardless, Jeff is an engineering geologist. He's coming to us with a degree in geology from Cornell and a master's degree in hydrogeology from Oklahoma State. And so it's kind of an interesting mix there, Cornell and Oklahoma. But for 12 years, Jeff had worked as an environmental consulting. But over the past 18 years, Jeff was in the regulation world. He was in the enforcement and water quality divisions of the California Coastal Commission, and he was a project manager at the California Coastal Conservancy. One of the projects I'll mention for that Jeff worked on was the tidal marsh restoration for the 1,200-acre Dutch slough and the restoration of 2,600-acre marsh or wetland up at Hamilton Air Force Base in Nevada. So those are, you know, kind of a diverse set of skills he's bringing to us. And we really are fortunate to have both these people. And so for Jeff, I'll let you tell us about your fun stuff.
Okay, fun stuff. Okay, so I have a family, a wife and two sons. My youngest son is a junior in high school, and I have a freshman in college, my other son. And I'm an avid hiker. I really enjoy. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought I heard something. Really enjoy hiking the Bay Area, all the outdoor activities. I grew up on the East Coast, and I'm thrilled to be living in the Bay Area with all the outdoor activities that are available, and equally thrilled to be working for the Water Board now. I feel like I'm returning to my wheelhouse of toxic investigation and cleanup, and in a different capacity than I did as a consultant. But I have a regulatory experience, and I'm interested in applying to my new job. And again, very happy to be here. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Jeff.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to mention that having worked at the Coastal Commission before your children were born and provided the mud for Hamilton, it's nice to see somebody with that kind of diverse background here. And I'm sure that Mark Delplane, the Coastal Sage, will vouch for you.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for supplying the mud. We need more. So if you can somehow finagle that, that'd be great.
Oh, that's Hamilton. Why I'm gray.
And then one thing I want to just pile on that also Emma Hoffman Davies and Mark Johnson, both engineering geologists in the Toxic Cleanup Division, have rotated into this new section. And the extra bonus is that the environmental scientists we went through and hired starts on Monday. So next month we'll be introducing her. And it's just been, you know, quite the hiring and onboarding process for me. It's been great. And I just want to give a shout out to all the staff and managers that supported the effort, because it was not small. So you're seeing the end of it here, and we look forward to bringing items to you. Clean this up. So that's where we're at.
Thank you. Is that all, or Tom, is there one more?
No, we have one more to introduce. But before I call on Jessica Watkins, I just want to remind the board that these hires are mostly part of an outgrowth of a batch of new positions we are fortunate to get this year for the site cleanup program with focus on environmental justice. And that's a new section. We create a new section that Ron now heads up. But rather than having all the new people in his new section, we did some rotating that that Ron just alluded to, like Mark Johnson and Emma going over to his. So John Wilton get the benefit of having also hire some new staff. But as you can see, we're really scoring well on high quality talent who want to work with us. So we just wanted to remind the board of that. But we have one more in the NPDS division. And Jessica, can you introduce Alessandra?
Yeah, Tom, I was going to say, I don't know who's more excited, Ron or me. But anyways, good morning, Chair McGrath and members of the board. I'm here to introduce Alessandra Moyer. I should have asked her how to pronounce her last name before this meeting. She can say it later when she speaks. But she's an environmental scientist joining us. She's our new pollution prevention coordinator, and she's going to be doing NPDS permitting, issuing mandatory minimum penalties, spill complaint triage, and also representing us on our pesticides collaboration with other agencies. We're very lucky to have her join us. She has a lot of experience. So she got her bachelor's degree in integrative biology from UC Berkeley. She worked on fungal ecology at the Bruns Lab. And she is doing her master's degree work at SF State University at the Vredenburg Lab in amphibian disease ecology. And fun fact, much of that work was conducted in the Pyrenees Mountains in France. She also did an internship with Point Blue, and she worked on marine predatory diet studies. And that included time in the Farallon Islands. She did field studies there, and she had the opportunity to collect California sea lion scat samples and amphibian skin swabs for disease tests. Also, her interests include theatrical costuming, embroidery, guinea pig husbandry, you'll have to ask her about that, puzzles, and roller skating. And I told her she didn't have to say anything, but I will invite her to speak if she would like to add anything.
Hi, thanks, Jessica. So my last name is pronounced Moyer, so Alessandra Moyer. But the way you pronounce it was really pretty. It sounded kind of French. And I'm really happy to be here. Like Jessica said, I have a lot of experience in biology and less experience with regulation, but I'm really excited to dive in and learn all about that. I've been here since mid-December, but obviously we didn't have the board meeting in January. So I'm starting to get my footing now, and I'm really enjoying working with everyone at the Water Board.
Well, Alessandra, I'm not sure that we can provide you with anything quite as romantic as collecting scat samples, but we'll see what we can do.
I'm glad you recognize what a wonderful experience that is.
Well, unique at least. As we said when I was at EPA, it's bread and butter to us. Tom, that finishes that,
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
All right. Welcome aboard, Alessandra. With that, we move to the election of officers, and I will open the floor for nominations.
Jim, was there a subcommittee that was put together to do that? I don't recall that.
Not exactly a subcommittee. I did ask Alexis to poll the members. So, Alexis, do you have anything to help us along here?
I reached out individually to each board member to gauge their interest in serving a one-year term as chair and or any particular input they may have for this year, 2022. And with the input I received, I conferred with ML, our attorney in OCC, and would like to nominate Jim McGrath for a one-year term as our chair.
Thank you, Alexis. Now, you can nominate yourself, so I'll give it a minute. There's no end of fun to be had, let me assure you. Hearing none. If I remember correctly, what we need to do is find a second. So for move this along, I'll second my own nomination.
Actually, you don't need a second, Chair McGrath. So it's not nominations are not made by motion.
Okay.
We just proceed with the vote.
So let's call a vote on that.
I'm assuming that would be me.
That's you, Victor.
Okay. Board Member Young?
Yes.
Board Member Gunther?
Yes.
Board Member Hacker? Okay, that's yes. Board Member Kissinger?
Yes, with enthusiasm.
Okay. Vice Chair Batty?
Yes.
Chair McGrath?
I'll say yes, and I will thank the board for their trust in me. And
with that, Yuri, could you guide us? I had some very clear direction from responses with regard to the vice chair position. Shall I make a nomination?
Please do.
I would like to nominate Jane Batty as vice chair for the 2022 calendar year term.
And I'll happily second that. I don't know, I don't need to, but I am willing to serve, I guess is what I'd say. One more year, guys, one more year.
Hearing no other nominations, Victor, go ahead and call the roll.
Board Member Young.
Yes.
Board Member Gunther.
Yes. Sorry, I'm having trouble with my mute.
That's fine. Board Member Hacker?
Yes.
Board Member Kissinger?
Also with enthusiasm, yes.
Vice Chair Batty?
Yes.
Chair McGrath?
Yes. And I would like to particularly thank Jane for her service and backup during this previous year, and hope to count on her next year. Thank you. This moves us to the public forum.
Just in time.
So I know there are some people who may be interested in this that we haven't heard from before. So I know I'll give Tom and Victor a chance to tell us if there's anybody in the waiting room who's indicated that they want to speak in the public forum. Now, recall, for public forum, these are items that are not on the agenda. If for agenda items, there'll be an opportunity to speak later. And while we are always interested in getting public input, because it's not an agendized item, we cannot comment on your testimony, but we'll take it into consideration and perhaps schedule it for a later discussion when all parties can have notice. Yuri, you have something to say here.
Yes, of course you can speak on public items or public comments. You just cannot act on anything.
Right.
So that's the distinction. So I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Right. We may want to ask clarification questions, but fundamental due process, particularly if it's a regulatory matter, makes it clear that all sides of an issue need to be heard before the board takes any action. Tom and Victor.
So, Chair McGrath, yes, we actually have a number of people who want to speak during the public forum. Three of which we want to make sure we promote are Ashley Wessinger, David Hooper, and Greg Diegas, if I pronounced that correctly. Also a possibility of Lisa Dunseth, but I understand she is just going to listen. There are three are going to speak on the same issue. And then we actually have another group that speaking on another issue that include, I've got two things open here, Stephen Nestle, Mary Sackett, and Renee Silveira. And there's a possibility, which I just need to maybe ask the folks whether that these two other people have submitted cards, Robert Johnston, or Doug Lovell.
Yeah, Robert just got added, so he should be joining us. Is there a preference on what group you want to speak first, Tom? And I'll go ahead and elevate the first group and then second group after the first group's done.
Let's go. Let's start with the first group, the one with Robert Johnson. And then, like I said, I presume as well, Doug Lovell. We'll start with Robert.
Robert is not in the attendee list yet. I will keep looking at it. Did we want to start with?
Okay, let's move that. Chair McGrath, it's your prerogative. It doesn't really matter which group.
Let's go with whatever group has their full attendee here, and promote them. And I'd like you to try to hold your comments to 2 minutes. I'm not going to time you, but we do want to make sure that everybody has a chance to be heard. So I'm also not going to cut you off in the middle of something really important, but please try to be succinct. So Tom, the first person.
Yeah. So I promoted Mary, Renee, and Stephen.
So Mary, why don't we start with you? Give us your full name.
Good morning. My name is Mary Sackett, and I am aide to Marin County Supervisor Damon Connolly. I'm calling on the Marinwood Plaza site and just appreciate the assignment of Cleet Carlton to this location with Ralph Lambert's retirement. Just renewing our request that this cleanup continue forward as expeditiously as possible. The county housing element and RENA numbers, et cetera, are taking a very close look at this site. And that's happening right now. And so just wanting to keep moving forward. There's been some changes in the ownership plan and just wanting to keep moving forward with this. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Sackett. And next in that group, Wesley?
Renee would be next.
Renee, we certainly know you here. Go ahead.
Sorry, that's my dog there. Thank you for your time. I just a little bit concerned. I'm actually relieved that Hoyt has decided to do the demolition and excavation method for remediation at the site. But I am concerned that, the flip-flopping does consume time, and that was kind of a big issue for us with our property and how it was affected by the plaza's contamination. I'm concerned about the fact that there are missed deadlines, and I guess the public participation plan due date was not honored and an extension was not allowed. So I am wondering about that. I'm also wondering about this remedial action plan, addendum number 4 regarding the excavation and the demolition and the excavation. It just seems that there's a lot of flip-flopping and it's just eating up more time. And it's really, really, it's not good for the plaza site. It's not good for the adjoining properties. It's not good for the properties that are affected by this negligence. Our property right now is undergoing a remediation plan and time will tell how it's going to work out. But these delays, the years that have elapsed, are really, really troubling. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for being here, Renee. I know it's been difficult. Wesley, the next person?
Yes, the next would be Stephen or Stefan.
Yes, congratulations to the Chairman McGrath, and I forgot who the vice chair was, but thanks to both of you. We, of course, have appreciated your service to clean water. And, at least listening to us when we come back these many times to make sure that the cleanup just stays on schedule. We had a wrap. I think it was, I honestly, I don't even remember how long ago it was. I know we started this in, I think, 2012. Just three of us initially took this on. One of those members at Cleanup Marinwood Plaza Now committee has passed away. We're still charging at it, and it's so disappointing. The board has issued its directives. We have missed targets. There has been no enforcement. And, you know, just the last few months, we were going to have clean up the soil vapor. They had to meet a target date, which they said, oh, no, we have to now have a public participation to see if the soil vapor extraction is going to go okay. And then that got washed away. So all this time that we've been pleading with you, that the pollution has been in the groundwater, seeping eastward, polluting not only the Severo Ranch wells, but also the property St. Vincent's. And as Mary Sackett mentioned, we are looking at these sites for residential development. We need action, action, action on this. And we're unfortunately, even though you've heard us before, you've issued the directives, there have been penalties in place for missing those directives. When it comes to failure to meet those directives, nothing has happened. So, you know, the polluter has basically gotten their way in delaying this process. So anyhow, that's all I have to say at this moment. I know Bill McNicholas, who is really our chairperson, would like to be here today, although he's getting medical tests himself. We can't fool around with this. I mean, really, it's enough already. If the board means anything, if your authority means anything, then your directives need to be followed. This is how you protect our waterways, our drinking water. So anyhow, thanks for listening again. It's always good to see this group. And I know you're all earnest and feel as strongly as me that our environment needs protection. So thank you for your service. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Stephen and Renee and Mary. We really do appreciate the continued oversight of the public on this and all matters that the government is involved on. You do make a difference. And I want to assure you that sometimes our own processes frustrate us as well. Tom, do you think it might be appropriate to have an executive officer's update at the next meeting or the following meeting on this?
Sure. We'll report back to you once we get, I like to get some specifics on the latest state of affairs and expectations that implementation is forthcoming. So I want to make sure we get the facts. I want to report back once we have the facts, which could be as early as next month.
Okay, so we do hear you. Now I do see first Alexis's hand and after that Jane's hand. Alexis, go ahead.
I was struck by the comment that the land ownership may have changed. And I just wanted to add my interest to an update. I feel like we talk about this particular problem a couple times a year. The deadlines get away. Even though there's such good oversight on the part of the management and staff team at the Water Board. And I'm wondering if we should, when the time is right, have this as an agenda item and discuss how we can
be more effective in moving this along. Thanks.
Thank you, Alexis. And next I have Jane, and after that I see Bill's hand.
I think Alexis captured most of it for me. I don't know if it's appropriate, and Yuri can tell us whether any staff update today, just an update on, has the property changed hands? And did they miss, I know we just talked about this, did they miss some deadlines? Just those two questions would be helpful to know, but I'm willing to wait a bit on a full staff report if that's your preference. But I agree with Alexis. I think this has been since the entire time I've been on the board and before, way before. So I would love to see what we can do to bring this to a successful conclusion.
So those questions can be answered if staff know the answer.
So I think that just the very simple questions are, has there been a change in ownership and have they missed compliance deadlines?
Alec, can you answer those questions?
Well, the first one, good morning, board members. I'm Alec Noggle, the chief of our toxics cleanup division. The first question of ownership change, I'm not aware that if we're referring to the actual source property, which is the discharger's property, has been sold. I know that there has been a change in back to an original remedy, and that's a little bit that's been disconcerting, but I haven't heard that land ownership has changed. So I'm not really sure what that was referring to, or if that was referring to an off source property adjacent. The other question, just simply, yes, they've missed deadlines. The big deadline was 2 years ago for a soil excavation plan. They missed that. And as a result, we did a cleanup order in September of 2020 and issued notices of violation and have, held their feet to the fire. And they've pivoted to a remedy, a different remedy, and now back to this original remedy. So I know it's very frustrating. Most recently, we have given them a date of this Friday to provide a schedule for the original soil excavation and building demolition plan. And we're looking to see what we receive and then consider our options accordingly. They have missed a public participation plan, which was due January 6th. We still have not received it, and we're very much aware of that as well. So I hope that answers those two questions very quickly. And
I know we all have a lot more questions, but that's great for today. Thank you, Alec.
Yeah.
Bill.
And so Dr. Bill, I'd like to. So my comments have to a certain degree, a large extent, been covered already by what Jane and Alexis have said, so I'm not going to repeat them. I agree with them wholeheartedly. I would like this on for our next meeting, if at all possible. I'd like, as part of the materials that we get in terms of the update, all the deadlines that have been met or have been set and then have not been met, and be in a position to actually do something, because I agree this has gone on for way too long, and our effectiveness as an agency, I think, is really called to the floor here. So if we can get a complete briefing on that, and I'd like a recommendation of what we should do. I think it's time. It's absolutely time.
Thank you, Bill. Andy?
I just wanted to say that I agree with what Alexis and Bill said. I also want to thank those who are presenting for their thoughtful and constructive demeanor. I believe that it probably takes quite a level of effort to control what I think is justifiable frustration. And so I just wanted to say that I appreciate that, and I look forward to hearing as soon as possible from the staff about the issues that Board Member Kissinger identified.
Thank you, Board. I think the degree of concern on the board is very, very clear. I appreciate that. Tom and Wesley, we have another group.
Let's call on the group of Ashley Wessinger, David Hooper, and Greg Diegas, if I pronounce that right. I don't know if they have a preferred order.
Yeah, I promoted David, but AGP, I'm having issues promoting Greg. I see him in the attendees list, but I'm not able to promote him.
And what about
Let's start with David while you work on that. Okay, David? Has David been promoted? And can he unmute? It's a little confusing sometimes. Just, I so much prefer in person.
There he is. There he is.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Thank you. First off, I'd like to say that when I come to State Water Board meetings on behalf of Solutions Not Sandbags in San Francisco, I'm struck by the professionalism of the staff, both of the Water Board and the EPA, and the board itself. So that's first. I'm calling today because I'm concerned about what is happening in San Francisco. Last fall, the State Water Board and the EPA reached a stipulated agreement with the SFPUC and the city to address specific, but not exclusive, specific problems at the Alamany 101 interchange at 15th and Wawona, and in the mission centered around 17th and Folsom. Hopefully over time, we'll be able to see the construction and see problems addressed. Last October, on October 24th on Sunday, there was another incident of, I don't know what we'd call it, an excursion, but basically a sewer flooding into homes. This time, and I believe that Mr. Carlin had already given a very minor reply to this issue when he, at a previous meeting, this time the issue was whether or not the PUC had created a problem. An active choices in construction and decommissioning of a sewer outfall into the marina at Marina Green. It's disheartening, but you know, this is a question of why the Water Board is there. If there weren't problems, we wouldn't need any boards. But I'd like to say that we're going to be continuing to work with the staff at the Water Board and the EPA to draw your attention to these issues, and hopefully there will be a solution that will address the problems that have been created by the SFPUC. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Can I ask a quick question? You talked about an accident or an excursion, and you related it to the marina outfall, which is in a different area, I think, of the city, or perhaps I'm just thinking of the Marina Green. Was there a spill that was duly reported and went into the water, or was it a backup into houses that went back into the pipes? This is just a factual question.
You are right about the Marina Green. There are three outfalls. One was decommissioned, the center one that flows north, and the water did come out of the sewers and back up into several homes for several blocks of the Marina Boulevard. Wasn't small.
So it was in a different location within the city. I just wanted to make sure that I geographically understood it. Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Next, I see Greg Diegas. You could correct
thank
my
you.
Pronunciation. I'm
no, Greg Diegas, so good vice this. Chair. I'm vice chair of the San Mateo County Midcoast Community Council, speaking as an individual. You're already aware of the 3 million gallon overflow in Pacifica on October 25th, and you're also already aware of the high level of BOD and COD at the Sewer Authority Midcoast plant, SAM plant, this past year. Levels so high that the consultants Brown and Caldwell stated they exceeded anything in their professional experience. I'm concerned that you might not know about the near complete shutdown of the SAM plant on December 13th. During that storm, for an hour, inflows to the plant exceeded its theoretical maximum plant processing capacity. Flows from Half Moon Bay increased 15-fold, consuming 80% at least of maximum capacity. But because the flow exceeded the calibration of the monitoring equipment, we can't know by how much more. During that storm, the flow from the northern agencies increased 5-fold, but was smoothed by use of wet weather storage in the intertie pipeline system, which connects the three agencies to the plant. However, Half Moon Bay has no wet weather storage of its own. The resulting overflow from the building housing the effluent pumps would have flooded the electrical building and shorted out the operation of the entire plant, except for SAM staff's quick work in deploying a portable pump to redirect that overflow back into clarifying basins. However, there was a small spill in Montara when a pump station failed during the storm, and that same portable pump could not be deployed to Montara because it was needed for the more pressing emergency at the plant. Long-term, due to sea level rise and climate change, there's a need to relocate and redesign sewer processing on the entire mid-coast. In the short term, however, there are 7 immediate actions that SAM and I hope this board can take. First, SAM needs to better protect the electrical building from flooding and overflows. Second, we need to enforce a moratorium on all new sewer connections in these agencies until the plant is certified secure from such future overflows. SAM cannot do this. The owning agencies and the county planning staff, and possibly this board, must enforce this. Third, Half Moon Bay must create wet weather storage proportional to its flows. This had been recommended years before by prior general managers of the SAM system. Fourth, agencies need to find and repair hot spots of infiltration and inflow into their sewer systems. And this is actually made easier because as a result of the San Bruno explosion in 2010, PG&E has been surveying sewer mains and laterals in San Mateo County. They just finished such a sewer survey in El Granada and Half Moon Bay and should have turned those videos over to those agencies just this past month. Montara has been waiting 10 years for a similar survey. Fifth, houses must pass sewer lateral inspection upon sale and transfer of ownership. This was a LAFCO recommendation to the county opposed by the San Mateo County Association of Realtors and quashed. Six, districts must test and repair homeowner laterals when sewer work is done on their street. Montara has had this policy in effect for 2 years. Seventh, Half Moon Bay uses a private contractor and no longer the SAM staff to do collection system maintenance. As a result, SAM lacks necessary oversight into the condition of the Half Moon Bay collection system and cannot spot and flag for repair the major sources of INI in Half Moon Bay. I'm asking the board to endorse these solutions, suggest others, and oversee their adoption and enforcement in Half Moon Bay, in San Mateo County Planning, and in all agencies involved. I will email the board the materials and articles supporting the facts of my commentary. I hope we'll have the opportunity to engage further on the details going forward. I am new here, so I may not understand all the wrinkles of getting things done. Thank you.
Greg, thank you for an amazingly well-organized bit of testimony. We will look into it. Thank you. Any comments or questions from the board?
Jim, I'll just make a quick comment since this is in my neighborhood. I had asked staff a while ago to keep an eye on this. It's been in the local papers, and I know that the Water Board staff has been looking into this. So I think these great comments, I would add this to the list of things that the board should hear more about. It's a complicated situation over here. With multiple jurisdictions involved and sea level rise not being a small part of the issue. But it also dovetails nicely with the TMDL work that we're doing in this area. And so it'd be good to see how we could align all this for some effectiveness.
Quick response, yes. And then to partly respond to Mr. Degas' points, please make sure you communicate to me, Thomas Mumley, thomas.mumley@waterboards.ca.gov, if you're going to send any information so I can make sure it will get to staff rather than having to tax the board with that exercise.
I'll just add a personal comment, having had a plumber out in my house this week with a camera. And I'm getting prepared to replace my lateral because I'm doing some work in the house. The advent of cheap video that is astonishingly accurate makes us so much more able to be able to track these things. So we are indeed in an information age, and we should use that information wisely. So there's there's a few more people to testify.
Well, we have last left is either Robert Johnston or Doug Lovell. I'm not clear which of them actually are in the system. Wes, can you confirm?
Yeah, Robert was sent the link, but I haven't seen him join. There is a phone number in the attendees list, but I'm not sure if that's him or not.
So I do believe it's possible to raise your hand if you're on the phone. Is that not correct, Wesley?
That's a good question. I don't know if you can raise your hand on the phone.
Hi, this is AGP Video. I believe you can raise your hand on the phone. You just press *9.
Okay, and that number has not raised their hand yet, so.
I'm looking at a phone, which is apparently area code 310. And if that's an interested party, we would welcome your comments. Hearing none, we'll move on. If they are somehow listening but not connected, as I hope you can tell, we really do appreciate public input. But it tells us things we don't know about or we don't know about in as much detail, and it is of tremendous value to us. So you can send us an email. We will try to make sure that you get queued up properly. And again, we appreciate. Does that bring us, I believe, to the end of the public forum?
Jim, I think Alexis has her hand up too.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Thanks so much, Jane. Alexis.
I'm just reminded that in the comments we've been hearing, the importance of our role as a water board in affecting the investment in water infrastructure, wastewater infrastructure in this case. It's obviously very difficult to corral enough land to have a lot of wet weather storage, perhaps in Half Moon Bay. But this is a time when there are infrastructure funds available, and I think the board can also play a role in how various districts and agencies adopt sewer lateral ordinances. We can play that role in a way that homeowners and residents cannot. And so I do think that if we were to take a look at the ability to have backup power, sufficient pumps, and to protect the coast, there are an array of tools that we can wield. And I would love when the opportunity presents itself in the next few months to have a discussion about this part of our area. Thanks.
Thank you, Alexis. All right.
Chair McGrath, we do have one more.
Okay.
Ashley Wessinger would like to speak.
Ashley. Hopefully you can be unmuted and you can speak. Go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear Nancy?
Okay, sorry about this. So I am a resident of Marina Boulevard. I have been involved in my community for quite a while. So as a result, I have found myself in the position of representing most of the neighbors on Marina Boulevard. From what happened on October the 24th, we experienced a sewage overflow. I would not want to say that it was a flood because it came out through the manholes at an alarming rate. So much so that if you were at the back of the house, you wouldn't even know what was going on Marina Boulevard. Many people in a certain block sustained an unbelievable amount of damage to their homes, with raw sewage coming up through the manholes and through the drains, some as much as $350,000 to $400,000 worth of damage. I myself lost my car that was parked outside my house. Some people have flood insurance, other people don't. Claims were sent to the city, they were denied and rejected. And as a result, I find myself on this call because we're trying to figure out how we wade through the bureaucracy of what I find a terrible situation that happened on the on October the 24th. I have lived for 30 years on Marina Boulevard. Other neighbors have lived on Marina Boulevard for 50 years, and they have never experienced anything like this. There were dead rats, there was toilet paper, and there was feces in that water. We were never given any outreach. I was the president of the Marina Community Association up to about 2 years ago, and at no stage did the supervisor's office, were they informed to tell the community that we would be at risk of a flood. A 8877 alert went out to say that there could be flood, that there would be flooding in the area. And that went out at 10:30 that morning. We were then, the peak of the flood really was at around 3:20. And at 4:05, people were told to avoid the area of Marina Boulevard. However, the original text was only for the entire city. It wasn't directed towards us. Then it came to my attention that with the three outfalls that we have on Marina Boulevard in May, the Pierce Street outfall was cemented in and abandoned. Now, that's another area where we were not told as neighbours that was happening. We were never given any information on how that would impact us, or if any feasibility studies were done to prepare ourselves for any level of impact. We have been told that we have to sue, and that the only way around this is to get a lawyer and go against the city on it, because they are not going to take any level of responsibility. They are making out that it was a flood, or that it was a heavy rainfall, but there's been many, many, many heavy rainfalls in the 30 years, especially in 1998, that we lived through, that nothing on this level has ever happened. I will say that I am absolutely delighted to know that there's a body of people like yourselves that will keep the city in checks and balances for the likes of me and the other neighbors in the marina. I cannot thank you enough for doing that, because we don't seem to have it in the city. I would have liked that the city could have explained to the neighbors what was happening through the supervisors. That's a very easy phone call to make and a very easy bridge to the community. That never happened, especially at a time when we have been told that global warming is going to be an issue with sea rise, and that we should not be impacting the system further by throwing the neighbors under the bus in terms of with their private property. If they had, on a basic level, they could easily have told us to move our cars. I lost a car. I don't have a car, right? So like, I could have moved the car up the hill. So there was absolutely zero outreach. And I cannot believe that when the water was coming into the houses, that was raw surge, and that the public didn't even know. We had no idea if they'd have washed their hands. They had no idea from a health perspective. So we're going to go forward with whatever we have to do. We will be connecting with Solutions Not Sandbags, because it sounds as though they've been through this before, and I really, really appreciate any help they can give us. And I really would like to have some level of communication with your board as we go through this, because we are just regular people in our community that really we have had no understanding of what we were facing with the city. So thank you very much for your time. Hopefully I've covered enough to bring you up to speed. I do have photographs. I do have timelines and any communications from the city so far. It's been relatively minimal, other than two letters of denial that were relatively sloppy in the way they were written. But anyway, whatever. But I want to thank you for your time. I don't want to take too much time. Thank you.
Ashley, I want to thank you for, again, a detailed and specific set of comments. We will take it under consideration. I want to assure you that I have a little bit of an activist outlook at all these things. So trying to figure out exactly how to get pointed at the right places is part of the things that we'll try to help you with. So that brings us, I believe, to the end of the public comment. Jane, hands up.
Jim, I just want to, I also thank Ashley for what must have been a very trying and difficult thing. Should she also be sending material that might be helpful to Tom or someone at the water board so that we can follow up on, we're in conversation with the city on other related topics. And so I wonder if the information she has, Tom, should that go to you or what's the next step for communication with the water board?
Well, we'd welcome any additional information. I'll just say this is something that we are actively investigating as well as US EPA. So additional information is welcome. So,
and Tom, yes. It was reported as a spill, correct?
We're well aware of this. It's, there was no discharge to waters, but it's one of these we're calling them excursions. It's not necessarily the best way to describe it, where you have overflow from the sewer system that goes onto lands, not onto state or federal waters. So, but we are well aware of this and are investigating what caused it, what can be done to prevent it, et cetera.
And Tom, I assume on our website that or Bill, I see you on there now, if somebody wants to submit an email or a notification or information, is it easy to find out where to click and connect with one of you?
Well, theoretically, yes. I mean, no, it doesn't come directly to, it's not easy to connect directly with us per se. I'll take that to heart in terms in accordance with our efforts to make our webpage as user-friendly as possible. But there is places where it allows you to file a complaint. And so that's, at worst case scenario, that's pretty straightforward.
Great.
Better case scenario is to contact us directly if one can figure that out.
Great.
And Bill, I see your hand raised.
Yeah, two things. So, good morning. I'm Bill Johnson. I'm the chief of the MPDS Wastewater Division and Enforcement Division. And so I just wanted to say, Cal EPA actually has a very good portal for reporting spills, incidents, or whatever they are, and then they triage it and send it out to the various agencies. So we're certain to get it that way. Of course, information can always be sent directly to us too. The reason I raised my hand is I just wanted to point out to you, the board, that in January, the executive officer's report summarized the larger incidents that occurred back in October. And in this incident was included in that description. So there's a little paragraph about it there. So so you're aware of the incident.
Thank you, Bill. And that also just highlights how powerful it is when residents come and speak with us. So again, thank you, Ashley.
Absolutely. All right. I don't see any other hands from the board. And I think I'm going to try to move us along to the minutes.
Yep.
There are no recommended changes in the minutes. You have the minutes before us. I would welcome a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll move.
Moved by Jane Batty. Second by Bill Kissinger.
Could I just ask a question?
You certainly may.
On page 5, with regard to Caltrans, I had asked for a list of the current projects that are being done between Caltrans and local governments, and I would just appreciate receiving that list.
That's a reminder, correct? Not an update, not a modification to the minutes, correct?
Correct. Thank you.
Tom, I believe we can adopt the minutes by hand vote. All those in favor, raise their hands. I don't know what that is, but I believe minutes have been adopted. This brings us to chair, board, and executive officers' reports. I'll start with Andy Gunther, board member Gunther.
Thanks, Jim. I just wanted to let board members know that as I think you most of you know, I've been spending a lot of time over the last 15 years speaking about climate change, doing climate change education talks in a variety of places. And Monday I was Zooming on behalf of the Castro Valley Library, speaking at one of their educational series about climate change. And I was asked a question I'd never been asked before in 15 years, which was, what's the Regional Water Board doing in the because of the changing climate? And I was able to very quickly talk about how we are working with our permittees with regard to sea level rise, and we're working on the restoration of wetlands for flood protection. And that was just a great thing to be able to do so quickly. And I'm sure that in coming years, I'm gonna have even more things that I can say in response to that. But just wanted to let you know that people are just asking these questions.
Cool.
You're muted, Jim.
Thanks. Next, we have Board Member Young.
No report for me. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, sir. Next, we have Board Member Hacker. Alexis, any report?
I have nothing to add. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Alexis. Board Member Kissinger.
Thanks, Jim. Nothing for me.
Board Member Batty.
Just a quick note. Like Andy, I am trying to get out there and speak on climate change and adaptation as much as possible. I am part of a panel coming up in March, which is with San Mateo County RISE. They're doing a conference March, I don't know if I have the date. And the topic is climate change and social justice. There's a panel, and so it's the RISE conference for San Mateo County, if anybody wants to look it up. But the conversation is happening everywhere, which is great. I tell people I learned everything I know about climate change from Andy, by the way. So
now it's always your problem.
It's always best to cite a reliable source. I have just two quick things to report. On Monday, there was the monthly chairs meeting. There are two things that I'll highlight for you very briefly. First, we're all grappling our way towards, can we find a way to have in-person meetings of some sort? Usually about every year, there's a chairs meeting. And we're all getting really tired of doing it virtually. And how we do it, perhaps with a hybrid or in person, is a subject, not just for that meeting, but for all of us. And the second thing that was up there is upcoming items that where the state board is considering a general order. One of those that may affect us, and that's dealing with PG&E, but I'll leave that without any further details until we actually know more. The other thing, I've had a couple of conversations with, and this goes to sea level rise, with, or I've had a single conversation with the woman, Danielle Mirrell, I believe, from Alameda, who has organized a climate change working group around San Leandro Bay and the areas of the Bay Trail, and with participation by not only the municipalities, but the East Bay Regional Park District and the EJA community. And it was just wonderful to connect with her and realize that this basic fundamental organization for developing visions is ongoing. And then tomorrow I'll meet with the resilience person, Katie Van Horn, I think it is, from the city of Berkeley here, and try to continue those efforts. So that grassroots organization that will eventually lead to the identification and funding of solutions is something near and dear to my heart. With that, I'm going to ask Sean McGuire if he's here, and if so, if he can give us an update. Sean?
I'm here. Hello, everybody.
Good to see you, Sean.
Yeah, good to see you, Chair McGrath. Congratulations on your election as chair again this year. So glad to hear that, and Vice Chair Batty as well. I'm Sean McGuire, State Water Resources Control Board member and your state board liaison. And so, you know, as usual, there's a lot going on at the state board level, at the state level generally, as you know. So I'll try to hit a few highlights here, and I'm always available for any questions or other items I don't mention that you are interested in getting an update on. I think we all know, you know, this year has been, this water year starting in October has been a little confusing. And a couple of you have just mentioned climate change and how you're getting asked more questions about that, and it's coming up and we're dealing with it, you know, right now. And that is, you know, we saw, you know, an amazing storm back in October, which you've been discussing a bit here. We had a decent amount of snow, actually record-setting snow and decent precipitation in December. And since then, it's been bone dry in California and continues to look that way. And so while we're, you know, all very thankful for any and all wet precipitation and snow that we have, we're still clearly in challenging times as it relates to the drought that we've been dealing with this past year and just the uncertainty going forward. And part of this is climate change driven, just the erratic nature of the hydrology that we're seeing. Part of it is just California and the hydrology that we've always had being a little bit unpredictable and difficult to know and forecast what's coming up. And so, you know, that's been a lot of our focus. Certainly I'll have more updates for you as we go forward here and as we get a better picture for how the water year continues to evolve. But, you know, certainly, you know, at the moment, I think one assumption could be that the water that we've received thus far is what we're going to have to work with. And we need to be prepared for that scenario. So, you know, on that, you know, one of the actions that Governor Newsom took last year that you'll recall is the executive order that asked for 15% voluntary conservation statewide for all water systems in urban areas. And the report I got last board meeting was that we did well in December, 16% statewide. So we've exceeded the 15%. I think the little caveat to that is that, yes, there was a lot of rain in December. So in all likelihood, folks were recognizing that don't need to run your sprinklers then, don't really need a lot of outdoor irrigation, and that contributed to the savings over what we saw in 2020. But, you know, part of the message here is, you know, if conditions continue to remain dry, we're gonna need to double down and continue to emphasize the benefits and needs to save water going forward. I know many of you in your communities already do an excellent job. Use water wisely out of necessity and awareness, and I appreciate that. It's just something that we need to continue. So one of the actions that we took actually in early January at the state board was adopting water waste prohibitions. And you may have heard about it on the news, and they're effective now. And it's very similar to actions that were taken by the governor and the state board in the last drought back in 2014. But think common sense things like, you know, don't water your lawn when it's raining, you know, use a shutoff nozzle when you wash your car. Let's not, you know, spray down our sidewalks and such when we don't need to. Don't let water run off your property from irrigation. So no overwatering, essentially. So basic things, steps that we can all take. Hopefully we already were taking, so it shouldn't come as a surprise. But nonetheless, we wanted to, we felt it was important to reiterate the situation that we're in. And it's hopefully will be helpful as we go forward here. You know, so on that note, you know, one of the big challenges, of course, as we go into any season, wet season, is, you know, our goal is to refill storage, to refill our reservoirs so that we're better suited for what is usually the dry season in the summer, and not knowing any year, you know, how things are going to materialize. And so, the projects, DWR and the Bureau of Reclamation back in early December were had an eye to that and had submitted a temporary urgency change petition, which relates to how they operate the projects, exports from the Delta, and manage water quality in the Delta. And they ended up a couple of weeks ago actually rescinding, withdrawing that urgency change petition from the board. So we didn't act on that because of the better hydrology. But we're still, I think, challenged looking ahead as to, you know, how things are going to go and having some uncertainty there. And so there was a TUCP last year and an order on that. And the board, actually our next board meeting here on Tuesday, will be considering an order acting on that action from last year. And so if that's something that you're all interested in, I can share a bit more about that. But basically it has to do with planning, forecasting, looking forward, understanding where water goes. And so you're welcome to tune into that on the 15th if you're interested. You know, a lot of this, you know, a lot of our focus this year is going to be on water use efficiency. We're going to be moving forward at some point here with our indoor and outdoor water use efficiency standards, which are our long-term standards. Not expecting that to be implemented overnight. It can be a little bit confusing because we have the ongoing drought emergency. And at the same time, we want to make conservation a California way of life. So that's going to take some time to implement in communities. So we're going to be having, you know, that conversation here in 2022. And a part of that is water loss control also. So just a recognition that a lot of our water distribution systems have leaks. It's just a fact of buried infrastructure and aging infrastructure and all those things. And so we will be considering later this year, for the first time, regulations on water loss control, basically requiring water systems to reduce their water loss to an efficient standard and an economic standard. So I believe it will be one of the first times where there will be a regulation that actually leans on an economic model to calculate what type of water loss control prevention measures each individual water system needs to take. So it's kind of a novel approach, but it's one component of what we're trying to do, which is move towards long-term water use efficiency. So shifting real quick here, I just want to, you know, kind of mention a few of the water quality actions that we're looking at coming up this year. One you may have just seen is our sanitary sewer general order. I've been working on updating that for quite some time. The draft order just came out and is in the comment period. There are a couple of workshops scheduled on February 23rd and 24th to go over the order and the changes that have been made. And later this year, most likely, we'll be considering adopting that new order. It's trying to build on the last order and really emphasize the need to continue to reduce sanitary sewer overflows, to get good data, to have a comprehensive plan in place, to think about climate change and those impacts and how you can better prioritize your collection system, operations, maintenance, and rehab investments. So stay tuned for that. We're also moving forward with our construction stormwater general permit update, which was last updated in 2009. And so that's moving forward as well. That's not out quite yet, but it will be something that you'll be seeing a revised or proposed final version that reflects on the changes of the draft that were distributed last summer. In a workshop that we had last summer as well. So that will be coming, and likely scheduled for later this spring or around there for board consideration for adoption as well. And the last item I wanted to mention is just on funding. And as you know, I think with the federal infrastructure bill, we're at the state board still trying to sort through what that means. But in summary, we're getting somewhere on the order of $6 billion over the next 5 years for drinking water and wastewater infrastructure investments, which is a windfall. You know, on top of that, we have about $1.3 billion for water and wastewater infrastructure investments from the state budget from last year. There's more funding in a whole host of areas, which I'm not going to go over all the details of today, but happy to come back later if you're interested. But things like emerging contaminants, PFAS, and the like, and just a whole bunch of different areas. So it's a really exciting time. We're figuring out right now, you know, how best to utilize those funds, you know, where the investments should be made, what are the program priorities, should there be any changes in our intended use plans and policies that go around that, providing safe drinking water, also looking at wastewater infrastructure needs, and just recognizing that this is, in all likelihood, a once in a generation opportunity that we have with this type of funding to invest in our communities. And so, yes, we have a lot of challenges ahead, but we're actually in a good spot to, you know, rise up to some of those challenges here in our water space. So it is kind of an exciting moment for me. And the last piece I wanted to mention also related to funding was just out of COVID, there was an acknowledgement of the challenges that customers had on both the water, the drinking water side, and the wastewater side in paying their bills. And so you may recall that the legislature allocated $1 billion for arrearages for customers to take care of their bills and debts that they accrued during the pandemic in a specific timeframe. And the water arrearages, drinking water arrearages program has been going forward and has been very successful. And we're on track to helping customers with over $300 million of their arrearages. So I'm really happy that we've been able to accomplish that. And we're just adopted the guidelines for the wastewater arrearages program as well. And I think the application is now out as of a couple of days ago. And so if you have contacts or would like to share that message that wastewater systems and oftentimes counties that are handling the billing have an opportunity to help out their customers and also get reimbursement on this funding that that they've been lacking here for the last year or so. So it's to take care of arrearages that are basically 6 months to 2 years old at this point. But nonetheless, if those debts exist, we do have plenty of funding available for those agencies that are able to take advantage of it. So I think I'll stop there. I could keep going for a long time, but I want to be mindful of your time and happy to answer any questions that you have.
Andy, I see your hand raised. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the great report, Board Member McGuire. I appreciate all the information. I wanted to follow up on the issue of the drought and water efficiency. We're once again have this amazing high pressure system in the Eastern Pacific that is really becoming, you know, possibly becoming a standard feature of our wintertime meteorology. And I know you're aware that certain data sets will show us that there's a drought in the Western US that's been going on now for over 20 years. And our record shows that the record from tree rings and other things shows that, you know, this is not, there are times where we've had very long droughts in this part of the world. And so when you talked about water efficiency standards, you were talking about, if I remember correctly, about just about the municipal environment, but it's my understanding that like 80% of our water is used in agriculture. And I wondered if you could say something about agricultural water efficiency standards as well. I'm talking about something I know very little about, which is why I'm asking you. And whether we're thinking too, I've read recently about analyses showing how much water we're losing to evaporation from our canals and other water conveyance structures?
Oh, sure. That's a big question. And it's a tough balance, and it's hard to correlate one-to-one, you know, the water that's used for agriculture versus the water that's used for urban uses and for fish and wildlife for that matter, and equate them, right? Part of the job of the state board is to balance all these different uses and recognizing that we all need food to eat. So that's an important aspect of survival, and water to drink, of course, that's clean and safe and all that. So just with that in mind, you know, I'll just say that a lot of what happens on the agriculture side is controlled by basically our water rights system. So, you know, essentially, you'll recall this last year, we went through a curtailment process where we implemented curtailments throughout the Bay Delta watershed. Knowing that, you know, most of the water right holders are indeed agricultural water users, they are impacted by that. They get less water, and they're always, I think, motivated to use water efficiently. And so, you know, in some ways, it's kind of regulating in that regard. And for example, SGMA, you know, in groundwater management over time is intended for them to reach sustainability, and a lot of that too goes to agricultural pumping and the water that they're using and ramping that down over time. So that's the supply side, which sort of controls in some respect the amount of water that agriculture has available. The other thing is there is a, we do look at agricultural water use efficiency, and there's a thing called an agricultural water management plan that these irrigation districts are required to update, I believe, every 5 years or so. So they do look at water use efficient practices that they can do on farm. You know, I don't have numbers for you exactly how that's translated to water savings over time, and it would be an interesting question. And I know different farmers and different crops, you know, kind of have different needs. And so that's something worth considering. But the other thing is that, you know, we're making investments in that. I think, you know, Department of Food and Agriculture and the budget has allocated some funding to agricultural water use efficiency. So good question, challenging one. I wish I had a better answer for you exactly how, you know, how to deal with that, but certainly it's not lost on me that it's something we need to be thinking about.
That thank you so much. I just one follow up. When you said that you were trying to remind people not to water their lawns when it's raining, I kind of thought that was sort of an obvious step that and I'm wondering whether you do have a sense that there is maybe a cultural culture of water use within our communities where people aren't really aware that they don't have to use water when they are.
Definitely.
Okay.
I think different communities have different levels of awareness and engagement. And I, you know, I can speak best to my neighborhood and the one I walk my dog through. And I'll say that, you know, I see people still watering, having their sprinklers on at times when they shouldn't and such. And so there's, I think, an ongoing effort that we all can be making to educate folks to know that you can have an automatic sprinkler controller and you don't even have to do anything. You can just set it and forget it and it'll turn itself off. So I think there's work to be done there. And I think, you know, most larger water agencies already have these kinds of ordinances and practices in place already. And so to the extent that what we're doing is sort of amplifying, you know, that, we hope it helps. And but we'll see.
So Sean, I'm gonna add a comment or two. As the pundits have said, for centuries, whiskeys for drinking, waters for fighting in California. And the critics, you know, the system that we have is pretty dysfunctional. Some critics estimate as much as 4 or 5 times what's actually available has been allocated in the water rights system. And changing, you know, whether that data is right, we need better data. Whether or not we can change that, simply is a very complicated question. And I think the cultural shift to understanding that we're in an arid climate and in a drought or an area that has periodic droughts is important. One of the things that I read about last year that is a real shift that I'm sure Andy knows about is that more than 200,000 acre feet that was calculated in the snow pack disappeared before it got to the reservoirs. So the climate that we have and the drier soils are sucking water out of the system in ways that we really didn't have the data systems to do it. And I imagine that's going to happen again this year. I mean, for a bicycle rider, it's really nice weather. For a farmer, it sucks. For a fish, it's even worse. But I think in all of this, what I want to do is highlight the good news and the $1 billion for arrearage. I mean, I just have to give a shout out to our legislature and our system for recognizing first what I think is fundamental to my values, that people should have a right to drinking water and sanitation, and to not hammer the poor and not hammer the water districts and the sewage districts who've been so hurt by the COVID is something that I think the legislature and our state board got really right. So I just wanted to thank you for that. I want to end on a really positive note.
You're here. Thank you. Agreed.
Any other questions for Sean? Andy, your hand's still up. With that, thank you, Sean. We'll go to Tom for the executive officer's report.
Yeah, thank you, Chair McGrath. I will just call attention to essentially the one and main and only item in the report, but it's an important one where we report on the answers to we received on a questionnaire under the rubric our municipal wastewater treatment agencies prepared for climate change, and the answer is yes, all are working on it. At least, and more importantly, those with high flood risk are taking action. It's also noteworthy that the questionnaire has stimulated further attention, and many of the facilities have committed to conduct more comprehensive assessments. So we commit to work closely on this, and we will, as part of permit reissuance considerations, but we also want to make sure we want to also engage in regional and sub-regional approaches, not just facility by facility. So it clearly falls right into things that we are prepared to do. And also note that we've sent a similar questionnaire to the industrial wastewater facilities. And so we'll report on that when we get them. So good news is it's getting attention, but there's more to do. And we'll keep you informed.
Any questions for Tom on the executive officer's report? Jane, go ahead.
Tom, I'll just thank you for the report and for the team for the report. I was struck by just the power of a good question. You know, yeah. We don't always have authority, but we will have authority if things go badly. And plus, we have a responsibility to the public. And I would just encourage our team to continue to ask good questions. I would ask the same question to Caltrans, to PG&E, to other major infrastructure providers that may or may not immediately fall under our regulatory program, but they will if we have issues. So anyway, just to really appreciate that power of a good question.
Certainly, thank you.
With that brings us to a very important moment in our meeting, which is a break before we go into the regular calendar. I've had some coffee, so it is time that I need a break.
But Chair McGrath, just want to remind you that there was sort of a special item that's not on the agenda. And I assume you have a plan for that.
Oh, yes, there is. But let's make sure that nobody in the audience is crossing their legs. So let's give us, let's take a 10-minute break and try to be back. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Jane, are you there? What do you think, Tom? Should I get started with the oath, since we do have a quorum?
Yeah, but again, I just want to you have a plan for the informal item.
Does that
require the oath? Although you
formal item doesn't, but it that also requires Jane. I see Mr. Informal here now.
But I definitely think it needs the oath, Jim. I mean, because otherwise, you know, who knows what lies will be said.
Absolutely. So, not on the agenda, but certainly near and dear to our heart is our recently departed executive officer, Michael Montgomery. And we had a really good run with Michael, who was spotted doing really good work for us and seized back by EPA. So I'm going to give all the board members a chance to say goodbye in as kind or jocular a way as they see most fit. And I'll make a few comments at the end. Michael, for those of you that don't know, Mike, your last day was the 27th of last month?
Yes, the 28th. Yeah.
28th.
Friday.
So, Alexis, you've seen probably more of Michael than any of the rest of us. When you were still at EPA, we probably talked, 8 or 10 times about Michael potentially being our executive officer. So I think you probably have the broadest viewpoint. I'd like you to kick this off with a few comments about what Michael means to you and your own way of sending him off. So, Alexis?
Oh, with pleasure. Mike and I have been colleagues for most of our adult lives, working together both at USEPA and at the Water Board. And I'm delighted that, Mike, your career has allowed you these opportunities and that we've had benefit of your skill and good humor and remarkable interpersonal skills in venues that bring our larger purpose together. What you were trying to do at EPA in the water programs, what you've sought to do as the executive officer, and now the challenge before you as EPA's new Superfund director are all really worthy challenges, and you've acquitted yourself so well. You're such a delightful person to work with, and it's been a wonderful time of bringing the Water Board and EPA closer together because of your ability to go back and forth in these roles. And I hope that what lies ahead for you will be as rewarding as the time that you've spent here at the Water Board. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Alexis.
Now I'll turn to Bill Kissinger, who's usually a little less reverent than the rest of us.
Well, I still feel outraged and cheated because Mike seems like he only got here yesterday. But I confess to my shock and my amazement when I look back in my inbox that, you know, we interviewed Mike in December of 2018, which I don't know where the time has gone. Of course, when I reflect on all that's happened since then, not to mention COVID and the transition to virtual existence, I have to take my hat off to Mike on doing this so seamlessly, carrying on and making the time go so quickly. So, Mike, I will miss you. You've been terrific. I know you'll do great things back at EPA, and happy that we'll at least be interacting with you. So best wishes to you.
Thank you, Bill.
Andy, I'm going to give you the next chance to comment.
Well, you know, I must say that, Mike, that I am sorry to see you go, but I'm pleased for the Bay Area that you are still here with us. And I'm struck by how the problems that we are facing now seem to be growing more and more in need of integrated regional responses. And I'm very, very confident, based on the work you've done here with us at the Water Board, that you'll bring that kind of sensibility and leadership to EPA and therefore to the region at large. I've only been a board member now for 2 years, and I have just been really, really powerfully struck by the community that is evidence within our organization. And I give you a lot of credit for building and maintaining that. And it's a very, very important characteristic for us to have as we move forward in this world of ever more complicated problems and seemingly ever more constrained resources. So thank you so much for everything that you've done for us. And I know that we'll continue to get a chance to work with you in the future, which is good for us and good for the whole region.
Andy. Board Member Young.
Well, thank you very much. And since I was the last one to join the board, I had a lot of time with Mike in terms of training and getting to know everyone and getting to know the mechanisms and gears of the Water Board. And the learning process was quite pleasurable. Mike really encouraged me to embrace this and to find ways that I could interact with everyone and provide more input that was going to make sure that our decisions were much more holistic, if you will. That wasn't what I was expecting. I thought he was going to throw some paperwork at me and just say, read it and let's get started. But that was really quite touching, but it really impacted me for the most. So, of course, Mike's leaving really puts the target on Tom to help me continue my path forward. So, Mike, thanks so much for greasing the skids for Tom to help me here. I'm wishing you the best of luck on the Superfund sites.
Yeah, thank you, Donald.
Board Member Fatty.
Thanks, Jim. Hi, Mike. So good to see you. Wish we were in person. I have so enjoyed working with you, Mike, and feel really, you know, just a lot of joy at having had the time together. Like Bill, I feel like it's gone by so quickly, but part of the reason it feels like that is because 2020 and 2021 sort of exist in a fog. So I'm sorry we weren't more in person then, but in addition to all the wonderful things everybody's already said to you, one thing I know about you, Mike, is that aside from all the lovely, smiley faces and, you know, just very collaborative, friendly guy, you're also very strategic. So I was thinking this morning that I would be strategic as well in wishing you farewell, because I was thinking that if I were applying for the executive officer position that we have open right now, I might be listening to this board meeting today. So I'm gonna talk about four areas where I think you were just amazing and that our next executive officer, I hope they have these talents. So positive, solution-oriented, always looking for how do we get to a solution. Incredibly collaborative work style, bringing in every resource that you need and really having open arms for everyone who wants to work towards a solution. Your enthusiasm and positive energy and focus was really incredible asset to our organization these last few years. And then last, your follow-up and consistency. So I thank you for all of that. And I truly hope our next executive officer can bring some of those skills to the table. And thank you, thank you. And good luck at EPA.
Thank you so much, Jane. That was really thoughtful.
It won't surprise anybody that I'm at least a little bit jocular in this. I have a nice Irish name, McGrath. I'm married to Colleen Houlihan. And as they say, there are far more people outside of Ireland who claim Irish ancestry than there are those in Ireland. But one of the things that you need to know about Michael is he swims in the bay, which brings to mind the Irish legend of the Selkie. Now, the Irish don't have a legend of a mermaid as a beautiful woman with a tail of a fish. No. Ireland's concept of a mermaid is a seal person who takes off their clothes. Now, I don't know that any one of us have seen Michael in a bathing suit swimming at the club. But, you know, perhaps the fur on his face spreads down. I'm not sure that there's not a walrus missing from somewhere.
Jim, I don't want to hear about the fur that spreads down.
But in all honesty, and to be the good part of that, people that care about the water are the most important people. So Michael clearly cares about the water and about people. He's helped us put to bed three raging controversies because of his style, his integrity, and he's shown us what a calm style can do. I work with him very closely. He was so easy to work with, much easier to work with than I am. I'm sure of that. So I will miss you. I am glad that you're still at EPA. The partnerships that we have and the ways that you've shown the effectiveness of partnerships are a treasure, and they will continue to be a treasure. So I so value you. You know, I've hired people that I've been disappointed with. You're one of those people that we hired that you just so outperformed what we thought you could do. And we got lucky. So it was really good for us. Now, before I let you speak, I'm going to ask for Tom and Lisa to make a brief comment because their perspective might be a little different than ours. Tom, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Chair McGrath. Yes, I thank you. I appreciate this opportunity. And speaking for myself as well as for staff, without hesitation, we really, really, really appreciated how supportive he was of us, both the staff and the management team. He was forever encouraging and helping us to be as good as we can be, better and advance ourselves, helping us be as strategic and focused and as Vice Chair Batty pointed out, focusing in on solving problems smartly. And so he really, really did add to what is he'll recognize was already a good machine, but he helped make a good machine better. So that's really, really welcome for me. And I personally feel appreciate very much the partnership that I was able to establish almost immediately and grew through his time with us. And very important part of that partnership, and this effect, I think has an impact on all staff, is just recognizing how nice and caring a person he's just super, so likable, but there's content behind just liking that niceness. So it came somewhat of a shock that his term ended sooner than we expected, but that's the bad news. The good news is that we've made some strong, we built a strong relationship personally as well as with our staff. And so we look forward to having him to be a continued part of our water board family. And we're going to miss him for sure. But fortunately, he's not too far away. And we're going to find every opportunity we can to engage with him, particularly as we seek his help in some of our major cleanup challenges. I'm going to miss you, Mike. We're all going to miss you big time.
Thank you.
And Lisa?
Thank you. Yes, I echo a lot of what everyone else has already said, so I won't be repetitive, but I'll just add a couple perspectives. One is that I think it's a real challenge to be a really effective supervisor and mentor and partner. And I feel like he succeeded in that way with each of us and in his style of overseeing our organization and all the people in it. I want to emphasize his concern about people and particularly all people. He really held us accountable, jumped way in deep day one and held us accountable to pursue diversity, equity, and inclusion and start paying more attention to environmental justice issues. And as well, the push on climate action and the ability, Mike's ability to hold us accountable as well as be supportive and bring more resources to those issues has been remarkable and a real growth opportunity in really some really important directions for our organization. I'm going to miss you, Mike, but he's going to see me because I'm in his neighborhood a lot because of friends and family, and we have interests in common like music and foodie stuff. So we're going to go hang out.
Certainly. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Lisa. Really appreciate that.
Michael, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I mean, my tenure came to unfortunately a premature ending there. I wasn't able to serve my full IPA, but the opportunity to come back to US EPA and serve under the administration with new leadership and, you know, advance a lot of the opportunities that are going to come with the infrastructure funding state board member McGuire referred to earlier. And I'm 1 week in and very busy reacquainting myself with the agency and folks that have been around and new folks. I really have to, you know, starting a new job really, you know, makes me reflect back on 3 years ago when I started at the board and just how, you know, supportive everybody was of me, especially Tom and Lisa, the exec team, the management team, in, you know, being patient while I came up to speed and really helping me to learn and understand the programs and really helping me to learn and understand the relationship with the dischargers in the Bay Area and the history of the both collaboration, but also difficult enforcement actions and decisions that have been made, working with state board. Can't thank staff and particularly, again, Tom and Lisa and the management team for their support during the time that I was executive officer. I was able to quickly establish trust with folks, which is a really important part of being able to lead an organization. It's a high-performing organization. It's going to continue to be one. Hopefully, I added a little bit of value during the process. I feel like I was definitely given the opportunities and the challenges and the freedom for the board to do the job in the manner that I felt was appropriate. And really, you know, lastly, just want to thank the board for having had the opportunity to lead. The 3 years as executive officer were, you know, life impacting, career impacting, and I'm just very grateful for having had the opportunity, for having had the trust of the board to do the job, and for having had the opportunity to interact with each one of you. So thank you very much. We are not going to be strangers, and I really appreciate Tom's comment about being part of the Water Board family. I feel like it, and there's going to be plenty of opportunities for more collaboration between the Water Board and EPA, and I intend to sort of help lead those efforts. So thank you.
Thank you, our special brother.
All right. I'm going to sign off before the oath.
That's that's a bittersweet moment. It was wonderful to work with Mike. It's sad to let him go, but it's good to know he'll be in the neighborhood. With that brings us to the official part of our meeting. And if I can get my screen to do what it's supposed to do, these damn pop-up things, I'm going to do the swearing in, but I have to, there it is, cleared. So here's the language for the upcoming items. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, second by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested parties. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witness by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person must testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibits, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of the process. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now, since it's virtual, say raise their hand. You promise to tell the truth.
Yes.
Thank you. So this brings us to the uncontested calendar. All of those items do remain uncontested. And Tom, I'll turn to you to introduce the uncontested calendar with any necessary staff reports, staff recommendations.
Okay, there's three items. One is reissuance of the NPDES permit to the Napa Sanitation District and associated recycled water facility. Then there's amendment of waste discharge requirements to include the Mid Peninsula Regional Open Space District's maintenance activities into those waste discharge requirements for routine maintenance and activities in streams that also allow for water quality certification for them. And then there's an action to just what is now an old set of waste discharge requirements for what was called penal point properties. All those requirements have been met, and there's an alternative regulatory oversight for that site. So there's no need for those waste discharge requirements. So there's nothing to add to that. There's no, as you point out, that I recommend you adopt all items as in your package. I think there may be somebody from Mid Pen to answer any questions, but there's no comment on the orders expected. So you're welcome to act on them based on what we sent to you in your package.
All right, I'll turn to the board for any questions. First I'll turn to the audience to see if there's anybody that wishes to testify on any of these matters. Take a look here. I don't see any raised hands among either the attendees or the panelists. Give a couple seconds for people to do that if they wish to testify. Without that, I'll turn to Bert. And are there any questions or comments? I see a raised hand there from Alexis. Alexis, go ahead.
Beth, I just had questions about just a couple things. In the fact sheet at F5, we see the discussion of the district's reclaimed water operation and water reuse operation. Tom, do I understand correctly that the recycled water deliveries referenced there are year-round, or are they seasonal?
Perhaps other staff could be more informed, but my understanding is year-round, but clearly fully utilized during the summer months, where the actually discharge to the Napa River is not actually allowed except under unique circumstances, but there is
because of the nature of the climate and need for recycled water, there's a degree of year-round use.
There was an interesting discussion about their SSO rate, and I was going to ask a question about that, but then I was looking at, on, for example, F8, the extensive list of infrastructure projects they're embarking upon to address INI and to deal with SSOs. And I wanted to commend the district for that investment. But my question then, not to divert for how important it is to make those investments, do they see any opportunity to increase the proportion of water reuse deliveries? Is there more of their effluent that can be reclaimed and reused?
Well, my answer to that question is yes, depends, because there's as you know, with resources, there are clearly possibilities to increase production of recycled water, which requires increased level of treatment or increased capacity of treatment for that. But it's sort of a given that there it could happen. We just have to align the uses nearby or sufficiently nearby to avoid pumping. You know, one of the challenges with recycled water from wastewater facilities, of course, is that they tend to be at the bottom of watersheds, and the use for waters are all upstream. But I think the general answer is yes, and I'll remind you that we are asking all of the Bay Area PDWs to do an enhanced evaluation of recycled water opportunities as part of a requirement in the nutrient watershed permit, because as we consider how some of those recycled water opportunities can either provide reduction in nutrient loading to the bay, depending on the nature of the recycled water, or otherwise would be competing for the funds that would be needed to further treat wastewater to meet to lower nutrient loadings to the bay. So it's we'll continue to give it attention, but I don't know this a definitive answer to your question, Board Member Hacker, other than generally yes, there's likely more opportunity, and I expect that the district is ever pursuing those opportunities.
I just want to note that I did go into the background documents for the Mid-Peninsula, the addition of Mid-Peninsula to the programs. This is a program that I think is very important to try to give a direction to what kinds of teen maintenance can be sufficiently directed with manuals so that we can clear the sort of the regulatory underbrush and count on entities with good environmental stewardship records and practices to go ahead with a reporting rather than a individual permit. It was a very impressive, as most of these have been, a very impressive effort, a very impressive manual. The efforts of our staff and the efforts of the different agencies responsible for stormwater and natural habitat and making that balance have built up a system that is truly impressive. It allows both the flood control functions that we need to protect individuals and institutions and facilities, and also habitat, and to do it in as efficient a way as possible. So whenever I see staff work that's this good by our staff and by outside agencies, I just feel compelled to thank everybody involved for the quality of their work. So I recognize good deeds where you see it is just one of the watchwords of my life. Any other comments or are we ready to make a motion for the uncontested calendar? I would welcome such a motion for approval of the uncontested items as recommended by the staff.
I'll make a motion.
Moved by Bill Kissinger, Board Member Kissinger, seconded by Jane Batty. I see the hand. Victor, can you call the roll, please?
Board Member Young?
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Hecker?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
Board Member Batty? Aye. Chair, Vice Chair Batty. And Chair McGrath?
Aye. So ordered. That brings us to item 7, the City of San Leandro. The renewal and something that we're all interested in, a nutrient treatment through a integrated levy. Tom, I'll let you make the staff presentation and any of the staff recommendation, any presentation that you think is appropriate here.
Thank you, Chair McGrath. Just this is actually an uncontested item. It is for a new NPDES permit separate from the existing NPDES permit for discharge from the San Leandro wastewater facility. This specifically permits discharge from a new wetlands treatment system that that has been developed on site. So it's permitting a shallow water discharge, unlike most of the discharges, as you know, are driven by historical basin plan prohibitions are to deep water. So this is noteworthy for a couple of reasons. One being it's an example of a nature-based solution that we're encouraging and expect to see more of around the bay perimeter as we integrate wastewater management into habitat protection efforts and sea level rise adaptation and resilience efforts. So it's just worth noteworthy. And another key part that it is an authorized shallow water discharge, which has been granting, which we recommend granting an exception to the basin plan prohibition for such a discharge because it easily meets the criteria that allow the board to grant such an exception. So given that noteworthiness, we felt it is important to give you a presentation. And for that, I'm going to call on Robert Schlipp to do the staff presentation.
Thank you. Robert, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Tom. So, good morning, Chair McGrath and members of the board. I'm Robert Schlipp.
Excuse me, Robert. You're not... Switch the display settings because we're seeing your view where it shows the next slide versus the full presentation. So up at the top, display settings. There you go. No, now we're looking at you.
Yeah, give me a sec, Tom. Hold on just a second.
Or are you doing it, Wes?
Yeah, I'm doing it. Give me a second. Oh,
you know what I'm saying then, right?
Yeah. Okay. Is that better?
Well, you got to share it. Again,
give me a second. Sorry, I'm gonna share it one more time. Display is a. There we go.
There we go. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Good morning, Chair McGrath and members of the board. I'm Robert Schliff, a senior water resources control engineer in the NPDES wastewater division. Today, I'll present a tentative order for a wastewater treatment wetland in the City of San Leandro. Although no one is contesting this permit, we wanted to say a few words because we think you will find it interesting in light of our ongoing work to promote more nature-based solutions to control nutrients and other pollutants. As an overview, I will first go over some background on the City of San Leandro and its water pollution control plan. Then I'll provide some information on the proposed treatment wetland. Next slide, please. The City of San Leandro is a member of the East Bay Dischargers Authority, or EBDA, which is a joint powers agency consisting of multiple member wastewater treatment agencies in Alameda County. The red circle shows you the location of the City of San Leandro water pollution control plant relative to the rest of the EBDA system. The city and other member agencies share the EBDA pipeline, which discharges treated wastewater to Lower San Francisco Bay through a deep water outfall seen in the blue circle. Next slide, please. Currently, the plant collects domestic, commercial, and industrial wastewater from a service area of about 60,000 people and treats it to secondary treatment standards. After treatment, it routes an average of about 5 million gallons per day through the EBDA pipeline, where it is eventually discharged to Lower San Francisco Bay through the EBDA deepwater outfall. Now I'm going to talk about the proposed treatment wetland that is the focus of the tentative order before you. The city plans to convert an unused storage basin into a 7-acre freshwater treatment wetland to polish a portion of its wastewater. The purpose of this wetland is to demonstrate the feasibility of implementing nature-based solutions for building shoreline resiliency, creating habitat, and improving water quality. Next slide. Here's a diagram of how this would work. The city would redirect about 1 million gallons per day of secondary treated wastewater that was going to the EBDA pipeline and route it through a new nitrification system that consists of membrane aerated biofilm reactors, which convert ammonia to nitrate. Then the city would route that nitrified wastewater to the treatment wetland for denitrification and photolysis, which means light-induced decomposition of organic contaminants. After this treatment, the polished wastewater would be discharged through a shallow water outfall into Lower San Francisco Bay. Next slide, please. Here's an overhead view of the water pollution control plant site. You can see the plant on the east side of the Lower San Francisco Bay and the corner map. In the close-up, you can see the proposed nitrification facility and treatment wetland outlined in purple, as well as the outfall location. Let's take a closer look at the treatment wetland. Next slide, please. This schematic shows how the treatment wetland will use two distinct areas to polish treated wastewater. First, nitrified wastewater will be routed to the top of terraced denitrification bioreactors, consisting of a series of wood chip filled crates underneath vegetated slopes that would provide a carbon-rich anoxic zone suitable for denitrification. This portion of the treatment process is similar to the concepts used in horizontal levees, such as the one at Oro Loma. After receiving treatment in the terraced denitrification bioreactors, the wastewater will trickle downward into a shallow, approximately 24 inches deep, lined and mostly unvegetated open water wetland that will allow for light-induced decomposition of trace organic contaminants like pesticides and pharmaceuticals. The wetland will also include vegetated dikes equipped with more wood chip filled crates to provide additional denitrification before discharge. The wastewater residence time in the wetland would be about 3.5 days. And this portion of the treatment process is similar to the concepts used for open water treatment wetlands, such as the pilot wetlands that were at Discovery Bay, where researchers documented successful removal of nitrogen and trace organic contaminants. Now I want to show you what the treatment wetland might look like. Next slide, please. First, here's a photo of the city's storage basin taken in July before construction on the wetland started. Next slide, please. And this is a conceptual rendering of what the treatment wetland could look like. This is an exciting new project that looks different than most of the wastewater treatment systems in our region. Nevertheless, our approach to permitting this project is very much like what we've done before. The tentative order contains the same elements of effluent limits and monitoring and reporting requirements that are in all our MPDS permits. We hope that this project will encourage larger scale, multi-benefit, nature-based solutions throughout our region and beyond. And I'm going to stop there and see if the board has any questions.
Andy, I see your hand after Andy. Alexis, go ahead.
Thanks, Jim. So thanks, Robert. This is wonderful thing to see. I've got one general question and one specific question. The general question is, the design here of the denitrification chambers, you referenced Oro Loma and Discovery Bay. Is it correct for me to say that based on what we've learned in the past in Oro Loma and Discovery Bay, we're able to design and confidently permit and construct this facility?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, what they're doing with the seepage slopes here is a little bit different than Oro Loma. Oro Loma had slopes of about 30-1, and here they're doing it at about 3 or 4-1 because they're trying to push a little bit more water through. But it does have the exact same concept of having carbon-rich environment and allowing for denitrification.
Okay, because if I understand it, we are, again, and this is something I've seen repeated by Region 2 over and over again, we are working collaboratively with our permittees to conduct scientific work that allows us to innovate and develop new and more appropriate water pollution control strategies as we think about our changing climate and our growing population. And again, I just want to make sure you're comfortable with me saying that. So that this is what's going on. Because I think it's really important then that we don't consider this permit in isolation, right? I mean, you guys have done a lot of homework working with BACWA and getting grants to do projects to make something like this possible. And so my hat's off to you, and I really want us to toot our horn a lot about the way we approach these issues, because I'm assuming that we will now be monitoring and testing this one MGD facility. And if that works, someone is then going to be able to confidently build a 5 MGD facility. And 25 years from now, maybe we'll be treating 50 MGD like this or whatever. I mean, this is the path that we're on. Would you agree with that?
That is exactly our hope, yes.
Great, okay. I want to make sure then that we capture this narrative as we talk about this, because I think it's exciting. And again, it shows how a science-based organization can really be influential on the scale of a decade or two in the region. I have a very specific question, which is when we are denitrifying nitrate in this facility, are we producing N2, not N2O, is that correct?
Yes, it's nitrogen gas.
It's nitrogen gas, it's not, okay, because N2O is a greenhouse gas. So that's an important, and we have the ability to monitor and verify that.
We are not monitoring like air pollution from the site, but the way it works is like on the bottom of the wetland, there'll basically be a biofilm, and the microbes, they take in nitrate instead of oxygen because it's anoxic conditions, and they just breathe out nitrogen gas. This is what Dr. David Sedlak has learned from his research.
Right, and I asked the same question of when we had the presentation about Oraloma, but I just want to make sure that I don't quite understand. That's my denitrification is denitrification, meaning you produce N2 gas. But I just wanted to verify that so that we are, as we go forward, building bigger and bigger facilities, we're not producing nitrous oxide instead because we're not aware that we're doing it. Great, thanks a lot. This is a great project.
Alexis, go ahead.
Thank you, Robert. I'm thrilled to be seeing this project come forward.
Could you turn your...
Yeah.
Volume is down.
Okay, how's that? So, Robert, my question, two-part question, is the timing of this. When do you think this project would be fully operational? And secondly, if once fully operational, is there a capacity, is there the ability for the volume to increase modestly over time, or would that just cut down on the treatment time?
Well, they're hoping to start sending wastewater to it towards the end of this summer. So that's kind of the startup phase. And as far as sending more water to it, it would reduce the treatment efficacy because you're trying to keep water depths at about 2 feet in the pond because that's how you get light-induced decomposition. And then also you want to have a longer residence time for denitrification. So they can play around with that, but the more water you send, the less efficient it'll be.
Thanks very much.
Are there any other questions from the board?
I've got one, Jim.
Go ahead.
So Robert, this is something we've been talking about a long time, and there's some projects out there already. How does this compare in size to others that are out there?
Well, this is relatively small because it's more of a demonstration project. So it's about 1 MGD. So some of the larger ones we have, I guess Mount View Sanitary District, you know, it's 2 or 3 MGD that's going through their treatment wetland. Trying to think of some of the others. So it's smaller, but it's not like it's super tiny.
Yeah, well, that's terrific. And in terms of when the water is in this holding basin, does it pose any kind of risk to wildlife at all, or the concentrations of pesticides and other chemical constituents that have been treated with sunlight? Is that a concern at all?
That's a good question. I think that's something that they'll be studying during the process as they go through implementation. I don't think we've seen huge issues to wildlife at other treatment wetlands, because the wastewater that's going there, it's already received a lot of treatment, right? It's already secondary treatment. They nitrify it. It's pretty clean by the time it gets there. It's just you have these certain chemicals that don't break down in treatment systems that that wetlands are fine to eliminate. So,
yeah, great.
If I could, maybe I could just add to that response, and that the types of pollutants that would be in the pond, again, the wastewater has gone through quite a bit of treatment. There's still some pollutants there, but they're more of a concern to aquatic life. So if they were discharged, fish and other aquatic life are much more sensitive than the wildlife who might experience the water in the pond. So the birds are much larger organisms. So it has to do with the concentration. And so I don't think that there's a significant wildlife risk to what's going on in the ponds.
Bill, it's Alexis. I remember during the Oraloma presentation, they commented on the permit holders commented on not only how many plants they used to build the levee, but the extraordinary uptick in species that quickly came to inhabit that improved habitat. And if we look at the current photo that Robert showed and the rendering of what it could look like, the improved habitat alone and the movement of water may bring us some gains.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you.
Yeah, so this is Tom, and I'll add that we welcome these questions because we ask the same ones, and one reason why we'll refer to this sort of as a pilot is to create yet another opportunity to focus attention to these big questions that could inform the long-term increased use of this, because that's always been an issue going back many years when this board actually established a policy for establishing treatment wetlands and how do you take advantage of the functions of wetlands, which actually are good at affecting pollutants, but at the same time not creating exposure. And so that's part of how these systems are expected to be managed, so that we avoid or certainly minimize those potential for increased risk. So but as Robert pointed out, we have no red flags from any other systems that give us major cause for concern. But I think the longer term issue is going to be the prevalence of contaminants that we don't know a lot about, and what may emerge. The good news is that these systems actually can knock down levels of what we call these emerging contaminants, and so that's good, as long as they don't create an exposure pathway as part of that, as part of being this living system. So we're excited. We're very optimistic that this will just be one in a series of success stories that we can keep bringing to you.
Just a quick follow-up question, if I may, for the management team. Do we know what was the incentive? What spurred the city of San Leandro to want to undertake the project? Because whenever we've had our discussions around priorities, we want to encourage more of this. What do you think was pivotal in them being willing to take this on?
Hi, good morning. Okay. This is James Parrish. Yeah,
James, you're James. By the way, you know, James is really the technical staff who's really helped make this happen. So, James, go for it.
Oh, well, thank you. So I think one of the reasons was San Leandro had a very easy opportunity with that existing basin on site. And I think that there is some kind of camaraderie within the region with a lot of our dischargers who do want to kind of collaborate and explore these opportunities for nature-based solutions for building shoreline resiliency and treating wastewater to better quality. And so I think some of that also comes into play because it does benefit. They know that it does benefit everyone if there are more of these nature-based opportunities that can, you know, be constructed at a larger scale.
Good. Yeah, I'll just quickly build on that. As you may know, when we had an information item last summer on Oraloma and in pursuit of additional issues like this, and you get presentations from champions of these efforts, there's a very progressive wastewater districts in that part of Alameda County are progressive, and they're involved in the local effort in terms of shoreline protection adaptation. So it's just a logical that they're stepping up with every opportunity, and there's more in play that we'll be coming back to you, hopefully in the not too distant future, with further or more permitting of. So it's just everything's falling into place, particularly in this part of the region.
I'll add my two cents. Like Tom, I'm excited and very deeply appreciative of the really innovative approaches from some of the sanitary people. I think to some degree, and I think we have to remember the efforts of Naomi Fager and the ongoing efforts of our staff in a collaborative way to look at nitrogen management. These are solutions for reducing nitrogen that are beneficial to the resilience of a treatment plant. I mean, there are similar proposals in some places in San Mateo County where there's flood hazard. There's a similar proposal in Western Contra Costa County at West Contra Costa County. And so they're looking at these as defining multi-purposes, which give them more opportunities for grants. But they're also a low carbon emitting way to reduce nitrogen and meet our goals in manners that are collaborative. And it's to me the heart of where we have gone in the last 15 years, which is to look for collaborative solutions, not merely regulatory hammers. So this is tremendously exciting, and everybody involved needs to be praised. So you have a recommendation before you, a staff report and a recommendation to approve this. If there's no further discussion, I think it's appropriate to have a motion to approve the staff recommendation.
I so move.
I second.
All right, Victor, call the roll.
Okay, Board Member Young.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Hacker.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Batty.
Aye.
Chair McGrath.
So happy to say aye. Thank you. So ordered. Bringing us to item 8, which is a little more complicated and substantially more complicated technically. Thomas, as I understand it, we have something that's not always before the board, which is the certification of the environmental document, and two items that have to be dealt with in order, but are related for the cleanup and remediation of our old friend, coal tar. So how are you going to present this to the board? Ed?
Yes, Chair McGrath, you're correct. This is actually yet another positive action where it's about requiring a good cleanup effort. over in the Pier 39 to Pier 43 and a half area of San Francisco. You know, some of us think of that as Fisherman's Wharf area. So it's a good thing, but it is a two-parter, because before the board can consider the cleanup order, it must take the CEQA action to accept the mitigated negative declaration and the associated mitigation program. So, and then upon approval of that, then the board can consider adoption of the site cleanup requirements. But we're going to provide one presentation that covers both, but then you will act on item 8A first. And then if you adopt the mitigated neg deck and mitigation plan, then you can proceed and take action on 8B, the site cleanup order. So with that, I'll call on Ron Steenson to give the staff presentation.
Good morning. Sound check. Can you hear me? Can you?
Yes.
Okay, great. Super. I'm going to share my screen now. Let me know if you can see this, please.
See the screen, just go into presentation mode.
Can you see it? Because I can't see you.
Yes, now. You're good to go.
Awesome, thank you. So good morning, Chairman McGrath and members of the board. I'm Ross Steenson, Senior Engineering Geologist Specialist in the Groundwater Protection and Waste Containment Division. Today, I'll be presenting agenda items 8A and 8B together. These two items provide the mechanism for the cleanup of contaminated sediments between Pier 39 and Pier 43 and a half in San Francisco. Although these items are not contested, Mike Montgomery had requested that we bring this project to the board. Each agenda item will need to be acted upon separately. Item 8A is a resolution to adopt a mitigated negative declaration and mitigation monitoring and reporting program under the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA. The resolution must be acted upon first because it demonstrates that the potential environmental impacts have been identified prior to the board taking action on item 8B. Item 8B is a site cleanup requirements order for the remediation of contaminated sediments in selected areas between Pier 39 and 43 and a half. Before I go any further, I'd like to acknowledge the following: Terry Seward, Chief of the Groundwater Protection Division, for his direction throughout the process; Marnie Ayejo, State Board Counsel, along with our CEQA consultant, Environmental Rule Consulting, Bridget DeShields and her team, for their significant contributions throughout the CEQA process. Lastly, I would like to acknowledge the significant collaboration with the Planning Division's former dredging manager, Beth Christian. In the rest of this presentation, I'll give a brief project description, go over the CEQA process, including the public participation component, describe the site cleanup requirements, and finally, I'll remind you of the two actions that you will need to take in order to approve the project. The purpose of the project is to clean up contaminated sediment primarily to protect ecological species. The sediment is contaminated with polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, associated with gas plant waste. I will be using this acronym PAHs throughout the presentation. Near the top of this map, the sediment remediation site is located on the northern San Francisco waterfront near Pier 39. Near the bottom of the map, the proposed location of the materials handling facility is Pier 96, San Francisco. This is where contaminated sediment will be dewatered prior to transport to a landfill for disposal. The facility will also be used for staging, capping, and armoring materials because there's limited space near Pier 39. Both of these areas are owned by the Port of San Francisco. Project implementation is expected to take about 5 years, starting as early as 2023. This is a large and complex project due to the physical characteristics, distribution of the contamination, and the maritime uses. This slide shows the project area map, and I'm going to walk you through some key features. First, near the bottom of the map, about 100 feet inland, is the former gas plant that is the primary source of the high pH concentrations. Manufactured gas is the forerunner of natural gas. PG&E operated the plant between 1911 and 1931 when operations ceased due to the arrival of natural gas in San Francisco. Now let's take a look at the waterfront and offshore area. The site investigation area comprises about 47 acres. On the right or east side of the figure is Pier 39. On the left or west is Pier 45. The green and blue aerial colors convey water depths, with green indicating shallower water and blue indicating deeper water. The brown-orange areas indicate the port's operational use limits. These areas are permitted for maintenance dredging. The blue lines indicate scour areas from vessel propeller wash. There's a scour area associated with each operational use areas, each one of the operational use areas. There's one at the entrance of Pier 39 Marina East Harbor here in the southeast. And then there are three starting from Pier 39 Marina West Harbor going over to Pier 43 and a half. These scour areas have a bearing on pH distribution and the remediation. This figure shows the five remedial response areas in lavender color. The areas are labeled from west to east, areas A through E. This corresponds to the anticipated sequence of the work. The black dots indicate bulk sediment sample locations. In addition, we show the operational use limits and scour features. In general, the cleanup process will involve the following: removing pH contaminated sediment by dredging each response area and placing the material into barges. The barges will transport the dredged sediment either directly to a beneficial use location or indirectly to a licensed landfill via a handling facility. At the handling facility, sediment will be allowed to drain for about 5 days, after which it will be loaded onto trucks for transport to a landfill. Back at the cleanup site, after dredging, the contaminated sediment that to remain in place will be capped with sand or sand with amendments, such as activated carbon, to limit pH transport. At some locations, armoring will be placed to protect against scour from vessel propeller wash or storms. Institutional controls, as well as a monitoring program, will ensure that the remedy remains protective. Institutional controls are generally described as activity and use limitations. Some potential institutional controls for this site include restrictions on the use of anchors in select areas, creation of no wake zones, and restrictions on future maintenance dredging beyond the operational use limits. The remedy will address both current and future risk by conducting sufficient removal up to 4 feet below operational use limits in some areas. The removal is designed to accommodate or allow for adequate cap and armor thicknesses. The total estimated volume is about 88,000 cubic yards. About 10,000 cubic yards is relatively clean and expected to be eligible for beneficial use. Most of the sediment is expected to be disposed at a landfill licensed to accept non-hazardous waste because of the high pH concentrations. For Pier 41 and a half, only capping will be performed due to limited clearance beneath the pier. Now I'd like to describe the process at the proposed materials handling facility. Looking at the aerial photograph, the area circled in red is Pier 96, which is just north of India Basin at the very bottom of the photo on the right. The proposed location of the materials handling facility is in the eastern portion of Pier 96. Contaminated sediment not eligible for reuse will be transported via barge to the handling facility for dewatering prior to upland disposal. First, standing water in the barge will be pumped to a treatment system. The treated water will be handled appropriately such as discharged under permit to the San Francisco sanitary sewer. Then the sediment will be transferred to lined cells via watertight trucks. The sediment will be allowed to drain dry for about 5 days, and then it will be loaded onto trucks and transported to a licensed landfill. Environmental plans, controls, and monitoring will be implemented and inspected to ensure that no impacts to the surrounding community. The controls will reduce dust and odors, spills, track out of dirt, and truck emissions. The Water Board is the lead agency under CEQA for this project. To comply with CEQA, in conjunction with our consultant, we prepared an initial study to evaluate potential impacts and determine that, with mitigation measures, there are no significant unavoidable impacts. PG&E has agreed to implement mitigation measures. We then prepared a mitigated negative declaration and mitigation monitoring and reporting program. There were four categories of potential significant impacts and mitigation measures. I'd like to point out the more significant ones. First, the biological impacts for aquatic and terrestrial species that necessitate surveys and avoidance measures. Then for both recreation and transportation, we have the same mitigation measure to reduce potential impacts to recreational boating businesses and commuter ferries. This measure consists of developing a plan to reduce the impacts, which will involve outreach and coordination, phasing of construction activities, possible temporary relocation while the work is proceeding in particular areas, and assistance with communicating service changes well in advance of implementation. We conducted the public participation, public review process concurrently for the feasibility study remedial action plan that describes the cleanup and the draft mitigated negative declaration. That involved mailing out fact sheets and notices of intent to over 700 parties. Additional outreach was performed by the Port of San Francisco before, during, and after the public review period with presentations by PG&E, the Port, the Water Board, to the Port's Northern and Southern Waterfront Advisory Committees. We received comments from four parties during the public comment period. The comments are reproduced with staff responses in Appendix B of the Agenda Item 8A for the Mitigated Negative Declaration and in Appendix B of Agenda Item Agenda Item for 8B for the Feasibility Study Remedial Action Plan. The most significant comment was raised by a community member in the vicinity of the materials handling facility. The commenter expressed concern about taking contaminated sediment from the project area located on the northern San Francisco waterfront to be processed at Pier 96, located on the southern waterfront, which is an environmental justice community. Staff responded that the project would employ standard controls, monitoring, and inspections to ensure public and worker safety during the handling of sediments at Pier 96. Now, I'd briefly like to describe item 8B, the site cleanup requirements. This is the order that approves the feasibility study remedial action plan and the preferred remedy and requires the Port and PG&E to implement the project. There are numerous tasks given the complexity of the project. These can be grouped into three categories. First, the risk management plan will identify the areas where high pH concentration sediments will remain in place, describe the procedures to prevent sediment disturbance, and indicate the methods of monitoring and maintaining the caps. Then, there are multiple implementation work plans and reports for the materials handling facility, as well as each of the five remedial response areas. Lastly, there's a task requiring implementation of the CEQA mitigation measures. We believe that this is an important project that will result in significant benefit to the environment. Therefore, the two actions we're asking you to take today are First, to adopt the resolution approving the mitigated negative declaration and the mitigation monitoring and reporting program. And second, to adopt the site cleanup requirements that require implementation of the cleanup. Note that the board must vote on each item separately. And with that, we're open for questions.
So I'd like to start this with any clarification questions from the board on the presentation, and that'll be followed by an opportunity for public comment.
I had one question, Jim.
Go ahead, Bill.
But wasn't clear, maybe you said it, I missed it. How are the dredge spoils going from Pier 39 to Pier 96? Are they being barged there, or are they going by truck?
They are being barged.
This has been a project of enormously long duration. I just poked around a little bit on the websites for the RAFS and RAP. The contaminants were first identified in 2011, 2013. It's now slotted to take place, I guess, over the next 5 years. It's obviously logistically very complicated, but is there a reason why it will take that long to do? Is it just simply there's no way to do it faster?
My understanding of most of these sediment cleanup projects is that this is actually relatively fast. So I have three such projects, and it can take a long time. And this was very complicated. And we had significant input from the permitting agencies, particularly US EPA and National Marine Fisheries Services during the RI phase.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. What's the cost of this project, do you know?
The cost presented in the feasibility study remedial action plan is a standard engineering cost estimate. This alternative is approximately $210 million.
Wow. And then one last question. What is carbureted water?
That is one of the, so I can't give a complete definition because I'm not familiar with the process, but it is one of the processes by which gas can be manufactured. The process that I feel familiar with involves coal and oil. So they heat up the coals and then they spray in oil into the kilns to really drive up the temperatures. And I guess that creates better burning capacity of the generated gas.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Andy, I see your hand raised. Go ahead.
My question is about the project, I assume, is happening because there is significant environmental impact associated with leaving the sediments in place. PAHs are a somewhat ubiquitous contaminant. I assume this is an area where there are very high concentrations. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us what the evidence is of the existing environmental impact. Is it sediment toxicity, or what are the impacts that we observe?
So the sediment toxicity or biological testing program involved, direct toxicity testing and also bioaccumulations testing. And so the highest concentration of pHs that was tested for direct toxicity and was about 90,000 micrograms per kilogram. For reference purposes, The Central Bay Ambien is about 4,000 micrograms per kilogram. And a very widely accepted screening level developed by NEMS or NOAA is 44,000 micrograms per kilogram. So the highest direct toxicity testing was about 90,000, so about double that. About 10 times that, 425,000, was found to cause potential bioaccumulation. So we have a little bit of a gap in our biological testing. So we saw effects at 400,000. The concentrations here go, in some cases, well above 1,000. So we're talking about extremely high concentrations. The remedial response areas for reference purposes are defined based on a total concentration of 100,000 micrograms per kilogram. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that's very helpful. The comparison to the 4,000 in the Bay was what I was looking for. And so we are, some areas are more contaminated, they're going to be dredged. Some areas are less contaminated, they will be left in place and capped.
Correct.
Okay, great, thanks.
I would additionally offer that the western area, areas A through D, due to those scour features, the contamination is much more intermingled. Over in area E, the surface sediment is actually pretty clean. It's only when you get now down into the lower portion of the operational use limit that it's problematic. And so it's that surface sediment in area E that we expect to be suitable for beneficial reuse.
Jane Batty, your hand's raised. Go ahead.
Thanks. Thanks, Jim. I just want to make sure I'm following the documents because I was looking at the neg deck, I think it is. So the neg deck, the environmental document, and the mitigation requirements, which are there's nothing about in the mitigation documents, if I'm seeing this correctly, there's nothing about the work on the disposal area or the temporary disposal area in the Hunter's Point area, where there'll be some cleaning up of the soil there before it's transported. I didn't see anything about the, you know, all the measures to protect the community in the mitigation plan, but I see they're in the order. And yeah. So my question is, they don't need to be in both, because I just wanted to check on that.
Sure. That's a great question. So the feasibility study remedial action plan provided the project description, which was then analyzed in the mitigated negative declaration. And so the feasibility study remedial action plan, which is of course tied to the order, describes plans that will pretty fairly standard plans, what I would say, health and safety, ambient perimeter air monitoring, how the material is supposed to be handled and placed into the trucks and covered before it leaves, all that. That is described in those sorts of protective plans and measures covered on the cleanup side of the project at Pier 96. As a result of that, there are no, those plans and controls that will be implemented and are required per task three of the order, and we will be inspecting those. As a result of that, there's no need for mitigation at Pier 96.
Yeah, okay. I guess I'm going to just defer to the team and the lawyers. It's a little unusual in my experience, but I'm going to understand it. I just read it. But it's always nice in the CEQA document to have, you know, these are the minimum of all the things you will do. Anyway, I defer to all of you on that, as long as, you know, the plans that will be submitted to our executive officer to protect the population in that area and protect the community, that is, you know, that's a very important part of this project. So
Jane, this is Marnie. I just wanted to add that that the mitigation, I mean, you can call it mitigation, but really those actions to monitor air quality and dust track out are not considered mitigation, but they're sort of part of the project. So it's just about, and they are mentioned in the CEQA document, which I haven't looked at in a while, so I can't say where, but they're in a list of the control measures. They may be in an appendix. Perhaps Ross knows better.
Yes, they're called out in the individual analyses, such as for air, but also there's a list of the plans and measures. The non-mitigation measures that are in the CEQA document.
Yeah, I mean, I think the good news is that if that's the way we're designing and building projects and we're incorporating that, that's great. Like to see that, but I just want to make sure we can track it and hold the hold PG&E to all those requirements.
Right, that's partly my job, right? So, or that is my job. So,
thank you.
And Alexis.
Ross, thank you for your presentation. In one of your slides, you made reference to potential beneficial reuse, and I wondered how realistic that may be, where the beneficial reuse could occur, what volume. Do we have a sense of that yet?
So they do have, yeah, so slide 8, which I'm attempting to share, but not in presentation mode here. So some of the surface sediment in air remediation area E, based on the in situ characterization data, suggests that the top material is relatively clean. The feasibility study wrap that will ultimately be confirmed because PG&E is part of the actual detailed designs for each remediation area. They're going to go out and perform additional sampling to characterize the waste because landfills will only accept data if it's less than a year old. So they have to basically recharacterize or better characterize for the waste disposal question. And so that number may change based on that. In terms of the actual locations, that was covered in the feasibility study wrap as potential locations. So the final locations have not been determined. Some of the potential reuse locations identified in the wrap would be, Montezuma Wetlands, South Bay Salt Ponds Restoration. Those are just some examples. If there's other locations that we know of, we can propose that to them. Those details are not yet worked out.
So once the project is underway, if there were some kind of community issue to arise at the materials rehandling site at Pier 96, would a concerned citizen be getting updates from the Port of San Francisco or from PG&E, or with whom would they be getting communications updates to address that concern we received?
Well, for the actual implementation of those plans that we talked about here, the environmental controls, just in general there, they will be, any sort of inspection reports will be uploaded to GeoTracker. We can let them know. There has been discussion of possibly having a, website for data, for the air monitoring data as needed. I think that's going to be done kind of collaboratively between PG&E, us, and the Port of San Francisco, since the port has been conducting outreach with its Southern Waterfront Advisory Committee.
I think I may not have been expressing what I intended, which is,
sorry,
in real time, if somebody had a concern, would they be going to that Southern Waterfront Advisory Committee, or where would a community member be getting? I'm just trying to encourage real-time updates, given where we started at the beginning of this meeting with the public comment session and people feeling, as one often does in a certain situation, you're not being given a real-time update. Where would that likely come from?
That will probably come from PG&E and the port. We'll set something up that way, since PG&E would be actually is actually going to be conducting the work at that facility. And so if something comes up, the initial question should probably go to them, and then we'll figure out how to answer it amongst the three of us.
Right, Alexis, are your questions sufficiently answered?
Yeah, I'm hopeful that we'll see both beneficial reuse. It's terrific that the materials are moving around the city on a barge and not in trucks, on the way to being dewatered. So I'm hopeful that this will get us some good, cleaner waterfront acreage there. Thank you so much, Ross.
Sure. If you don't mind, I'd like to add one some additional notes on the materials handling facility.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So this facility has been used for handling these types of materials before, perhaps not, this type of material, but has been used for handling sediment before. It's actually of the facilities looked at, although the final decision to lease it has not been, implemented yet. It does have a number of benefits. Additionally, the truck traffic will not go through neighborhoods, and so it can get to the freeway without actually traversing the Bayview Hunters Point, residential areas. So I just wanted to add that piece.
Thank you. I'm going to add some comments. The one question I had was answered here, which is the off-haul will be covered, and that's a matter of project description rather than mitigation. I did a pretty deep dive into this for a couple of reasons. I started because I couldn't read the graphics really well, so I downloaded the remedial action plan, where the graphics were wonderful and I could figure out what was going on. The other reason is I used to be involved in a group of people that taught cleaning up contaminated sediments at ports. A professor at the University of Wisconsin, we gave courses all around the country. So I've done this for a living and encountered coal tar in the Port of Oakland. And one of the questions was, should you leave it in place? And part of the solution that we had at the Port of Oakland, next to the Howard Terminal from the same source, the old coal gasification plant, was it's got 8 feet of cleaner sediment on it, leave it alone. This is very different because, and the analysis in the presentation by Ross was really excellent. The problem here is that while you had material that may have been, at one point been buried, marine activity with large enough vessels were spreading this around. They were scouring out of the sediment bed, so you really couldn't leave it alone. While that process also diluted it, it was a pathway back to the environment, and we don't really like those. And I found the analysis of excellent quality and compelling about the source. I also looked at the sampling pattern, which was really comprehensive. As Ross said to Andy, the levels here are pretty screamingly high. I also shared Board Member Batty's concern about the potential impact. So I listened pretty carefully today. The good things that I find, first of all, the last thing that Ross said is, this is the best place to be able to truck it without any exposure in the neighborhood, either to the material, which is going to be covered, or the like. The second thing, and it was clarified today, is that this isn't going to be dry to the point where you're going to have fugitive dust and volatility. You're talking about a 5-day period. It's still going to be really wet. It's unfortunate because you have to haul a bunch of water. But it's fortunate in the sense that in terms of exposure to the public, that's the best way to haul it. It does involve additional costs. It does involve additional carbon emissions. But I think that's the right balance. And then the right combination of capping and institutional controls and getting it out where it's likely to be scoured. I found this comprehensive, because I used to do so much of this. I also found it fascinating, so I ended up digging around in the reports for quite a while. it's really good work. I wish the people from Hunters Point were here to hear some of this in a little bit greater detail. We do have their back, and it's important that we look in detail. And I really appreciate, Jane, your concern for that. I followed it the same way, and the staff work here by Ross is great. I waited to make my comments to make sure there was nobody in the public. I'm always really pleased when I see this quality of staff work from our staff, and Ross, your grasp of it is obvious, and also from the dischargers. So it is complicated. That's a lot of sampling. That's generally done in sequence. So I know, Bill, it's slow, but it's steady. So is really
good. Thank you, Jim. Well, I took your class in Albany, New York in 1998.
Oh, you did?
So maybe that's why it's there's the answer, right? So,
well, I was one of several.
Right, right.
But you clearly got the lessons.
Right.
And well, that's a small world story.
It is a small world. We do have Catherine Purcell from the Port of San Francisco who wanted to offer a few comments, by the way. So,
Catherine, go ahead.
Catherine's been promoted.
Unmute.
We can hear you.
I was hoping you could see me.
Just turn on your camera, I think. I think you've got the capacity to do that.
Give me 1 second. Hi there. Give me 1 second. Sorry, it's taken over both screens.
There you are. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much. My name is Catherine Purcell. As the Port of San Francisco's Pier 39 to 45 project manager, I would like to acknowledge the ongoing efforts of the Regional Water Board staff and all of their work with the port, with PG&E, and with a large team of technical consultants to first develop and then to implement the investigation work plans. This collaboration has resulted in the completion of over 4 years of sediment, soil, and groundwater investigations to characterize the extent of sediment contamination within the Pier 39 to 45 offshore site boundaries. We appreciate the project team's attention to working with the port's tenants within 39 to 43, as well as the state and federal regulatory agencies to technically review and interpret the extensive data that has been generated as a result of these studies and the subsequent remedial investigation findings. Ross and Water Board staff, thank you for your help in working through the feasibility study and the remedial action plan for this complex project and the impact analysis and mitigation measures detailed in the MND and the supporting initial study. We find that the information in the tentative order is helpful in defining what PG&E and the port will be required to implement to demonstrate compliance with the mitigation measures for the remediation of contaminated sediments between Pier 39 and Pier 43 and a half. The port also appreciates the public participation efforts that have been made by both the board and PG&E, including outreach to other agencies to obtain technical review and input, not only on site characterization and the remedial investigation, but on the remedial design and the mitigation monitoring and reporting requirements over the upcoming years. Public participation and briefings have fostered open dialogue between port staff, our waterfront stakeholders, and the Port's Advisory Committee members and the public. This has included PG&E's proposal to lease available space at our Pier 96 terminal to support a materials handling facility during construction, currently scheduled to begin a year and a half or so from now in June of 2023. I want to note that the Port is actively working with PG&E and the Southern Waterfront community to better understand the proposed sediment handling operations and the environmental and safety controls to be implemented, and if the sediment handling operations can proceed at Pier 96. Thank you for your time to comment on behalf of the Port.
Thank you, Catherine. If there's no more comments from the board or questions, I think we can proceed. We have a recommendation before us. The first item for consideration is item A, adoption of the mitigated negative declaration and mitigation monitoring reporting program, which, as noted, has some elements of the necessary mitigation included in the project description, so they need not be repeated in the mitigation program. Can I have a motion to approve that?
Chair McGrath, just for clarification for the record, the recommendation is to adopt the tentative resolution, which approves the mitigated NEDEC and mitigation program. So
just I sit corrected. I'm still looking for that motion.
So moved.
I'll move.
Or I'll second.
I'll second.
Victor, we'll leave you to sort it out. We know the usual suspects. Victor, can you call the roll on that, please?
Sure. Board Member Young.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Hacker.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Batty.
Aye.
Chair McGrath.
Aye. So ordered. Terry got to say that. I like being able to do that, you know. I like what Terry did it too, though. Now that brings us to item B, Pacific Gas and Electric Company in the Port of San Francisco, the adoption of the site cleanup requirements. Did I get this one right, Tom?
Yes, you did.
Okay. So I'm looking for a motion to adopt that resolution.
No, this is not a resolution.
This is the site cleanup requirement.
That's correct.
Keep me out of trouble. Yes.
And I'm so moved.
Donald has moved. Can I get a second?
Second.
Second from Andrew. Victor, call the roll.
Board Member Young.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Hacker.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Batty.
Aye.
Chair McGrath.
Aye. So ordered. That brings us to the close of our regular agenda item. We are going to reconvene in a closed session to discuss personnel matters. But before we do that, we're going to take a little more than a half hour break. I want to give everybody a chance. Does anyone need a longer than a half hour to get some nourishment and stretch their legs?
Could we just do 1:15, regather at 1:15?
That's why I asked. 1:15 it is. Let's regather at 1:15. You have the link. It's on a different one. Before we go, Marnie and Yuri have their hands raised to once again keep me out of trouble. Marnie, go ahead.
Could you adjourn this meeting before taking the break?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. And before you adjourn, Jim, if someone could recirculate that link. I'm not sure that I saw the link for the.
I don't think I did either. Yeah.
I did see it in my email lead. So
it has just been resent at the start of our meeting by Wes.
Okay. Great. Yuri, your hands down. Marnie covered it.
Correct. I just wanted to note that ML is on vacation, so Michael Loffer will be joining you in the closed session.
Right. And I do understand that. So with that, I will adjourn this meeting and we will later reconvene in closed session. Have a good lunch, stretch your legs. Thank you all for, and thanks for the staff work today. I mean, it was really, really, really good.
I agree, it really was. Thanks all.
Thank you.
Hey, Tom.
Yes?
I don't seem to have the closed session link.